Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Lyric Stage, presenting The Drowsy Chaperone. This bubbly love letter to musical theater includes mix-ups, mayhem, and a wedding or two. Now through May 12th at Lyric Stage Boston. Tickets at lyricstage.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Senator Elizabeth Warren joins us for an hour live 11 to noon at the Boston Public Library for a special edition of Ask the Senator. She'll take our questions and your calls and texts on the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago, student loans, and the sorry state of the tea.
Attorney General Merrick Garland has announced the Department of Justice is seeking to unseal the FBI's search warrant of Mar-a-Lago, where agents reportedly sought documents relating to nuclear weapons. Retired federal judge Nancy Gertner joins us to discuss that and more. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are live from the Boston Public Library, as we are every Tuesday and every Friday. And we do want to thank the crowd that came down here. We have a big crowd today. Maybe it could have something to do with our first guest here and all the people from GBH's Beacon Circle. We're very grateful for you guys showing up here as well. And we are streaming on YouTube at youtube.com/WGBH News if you want to watch us on kind of TV.
Even though I'd come down. So here to tell us if she has any classified documents concerning nuclear weapons in her house is Senator Elizabeth Warren. The senator will be fielding our questions. The senator will be fielding our questions and, much more importantly, yours. For the first time, you can call or text her your questions. 877-301-8970. You can also tweet the senator at BOS Public Radio. And if you're in the audience here at the library and want to ask a question, you find our colleague Annie, who is about to raise her hand, and she will go through those questions. We'll get to as many as we can. Senator, it's wonderful to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm great to be here with all the people at Boston Public Library. I see AARP is in the house as well. Go get them.
Yeah, Senator, thank you very, very much for being here. So Jim alluded to a report from the Washington Post that said that FBI agents were looking for documents relating to nuclear weapons at the president's Mar-a-Lago house, or estate, I should call it, big house. Uh-huh. You know, when you hear the word nuclear weapons, it makes you a little bit nervous. So what do you make of all this?
So, look, it's an ongoing investigation, so I don't have a comment on the content. But I will say this. I think it's really important to give the Department of Justice the space to collect the evidence that they think is important and then to follow that evidence and prosecute anyone that they think has broken the law. No one is above the law, and that includes former presidents of the United States.
You know, we were talking about political violence yesterday, and a poll, which is not new, unfortunately, that what 1 in 3 in this country say they believe political violence may be appropriate in certain circumstances. I think we've all heard about this man who went into the Cincinnati office of the FBI after a posting on Truth Social. I recommend going and being Florida. I think the feds won't break it up. If they do, kill them. Ultimately, the agents, after a six-hour attempt to get him to drop his weapons and surrender, had to kill him. The normalization of at least threats of political violence, not to mention actual political violence, is horrifying. Mm-hmm. I mean, do we even have the ability to... I mean, maybe we can protect the Capitol after January 6th. I'm not even sure we can do that. What level of worry do you have about this?
Look, I'm really worried, and I'm worried about it because of what it means for our democracy. I'm worried about it when elected leaders on the Republican side use language of violence, and they are, as you say, they're normalizing it. And the heart of a democracy is that all the citizens get a vote, they get that vote counted, and then we all abide by the outcome of that vote. That's just the deal. That's like the core foundational piece of a democracy. And when it becomes violence, then it's something else. It's about dictatorships. It's about who's got the most guns or who's got the people who are willing to attack the hardest. And so the threat to what this means to the nation we have built, that our forebearers for centuries going back said, we are going to be a nation. What is one of the things that people like to talk about George Washington that I've always loved? One of the most extraordinary things he did?
His wooden teeth?
No, okay. But close. That after two terms, he actually walked away. Yeah. Peaceful transition of power to John Adams. Remember for those of you who've seen Hamilton, either in the video form or live, when they talk about the King of England saying, I didn't know you could do that, right? That you could actually walk away. But that's who we are. And Donald Trump, I know he's broken a lot of norms, and a lot of people are totally behind him on that. But this one is breaking the heart of our democracy.
Do you think he's broken laws, too, not just norms? I know you want to wait till the DOJ does what they do. But you're a pretty talented law professor, I'm told, at that school across the river. Based on what you know as either a senator or just a citizen, do you think he's violated criminal laws?
I am also a responsible senator, and that means I'm giving the Department of Justice all the space they need to do what is right, to do it fairly, without fear, without favor, to follow where the evidence leads them and do what's right.
You know, one last thing before we start taking the calls and the text at 877-301-8970. Sure. I mean, you are in the Senate. You know your colleagues. You know some people in the House. Again, I mentioned that when you hear nuclear weapons, it makes people nervous. And when you see things like what's going on in Mar-a-Lago makes people nervous. When you saw January 6th, obviously makes you nervous, the revelations from the January 6th committee. So I'm wondering if you feel as though we're up to this task after January 6th of combating these political threats and political violence and keeping people safe. I mean, there's a kind of an unease that I remember from back in, you know, the horror years of 68, 69, mm-hmm. with demonstrations in the street and assassinations, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. The whole notion of breakdown,
right,
of how we understand who we are and how we work together. I got to say, though, Marjorie, I'm actually feeling kind of optimistic. I mean, we're less than 100 days out until the midterms, and wow, talk about there's no blurring between what it is the Republicans are running for and what it is that the Democrats are running for. And I get it. It's uphill. Everybody can tell me the stories about, you know, midterms, the party in the White House tends to lose. I get it. I get it about gerrymandering and how we're running uphill on that. But the reality is we got a lot to talk about here in ways that are not bank shots, that are not difficult to thread out long stories. One party, the Democrats, said we are going to reduce carbon emission by 40% in the next 8 years. And we couldn't get one single Republican vote in Congress. One party said enough, finally, we've had it. We are going to force the giant drug companies to negotiate with Medicare, and we are going to cap the cost of insulin for Medicare recipients at $35, cap their out-of-pockets at $2,000 eventually by 2026. One party said we're going to do that. That's the Democrats. The Republicans all voted against it. So I think we got big things to talk about, big differences between the parties. We get people out to vote. I truly do believe in democracy. I think that if we get out and talk about our vision for America and America that works together, then I think we've got a chance to pull this thing back from the edge and engage more people and make this a country that actually works, not just for a handful at the top or a handful who've got guns, but make it work for everybody.
I want to ask you one more thing about the country working, Senator, before we do get to the calls. By the way, we misspoke before. YouTube.com/GBH News, not WGBH News.
Sorry,
GBH News.
Just my fault.
No, it's okay. One last thing about it. Marjorie and I are having a disagreement. Maybe it's inappropriate to ask you to settle it, but if you don't mind, can I do this? One of us thinks that it's not that unfair to ask riders of the T to some days have to jump in the Mystic or bring a ladder with them to get home, and the other one thinks that's inappropriate. Where are you on this?
I'm kind kind of with, you shouldn't have to worry about the tea bursting into flames while you're on it. Right.
Should the feds take over the tea?
You know, I can't tell you how frustrated I am about this. The job of the feds is not to take over. It's not to come in and run a school district. It's not to come in and run a transit system. It's to be a good partner. And I have tried so hard to be a good partner, to help them get the money they need, because that's the main way, and to help them get the support and help them get the structure. And others in our delegation have too. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley has been really hard on this. Congressman Stephen Lynch, my partner Ed Markey, we are there to try to get support for the T. And the T has had a monumental failure in leadership. And not just for the last month, not just for the last year, it is years long now that leadership at the T has failed. And now the riders are the ones who have to pay the price. So for me, it is time to hold some folks accountable. It's time to do some house cleaning at the top and get somebody who runs the T, who actually uses the resources that are available to them, so everybody has access to a safe and dependable ride.
What does the top mean? Because obviously it's going to be a new governor. I don't know if you mean that. Do you mean Steve Poftek, the head of the T? What do you mean?
The governor owns this. Can we just stop there? Full stop. The governor has had 8 years on the T. He is the one who has selected people. And this rests with the governor. So I get it. We're going to get a new governor soon. But we got to have new people running the T.
What do you say if a constituent, last question before we do get to the calls, either a mayor says, I can't even tell my constituents what the substitute for the orange line is going to be, or a regular constituent, not an elected official, says, I'm not going to be able to get to work or the doctor. What do you tell them?
But that's the whole point. That's what I mean. We count on having good leadership. And good leadership is before you say, I'm taking that thing away, you got something else in place for people to be able to rely on. And they just haven't done that.
Let's go to Rick in Cambridge. You're first with Senator Elizabeth Warren. We are live at the Boston Public Library. Hello there, Rick.
Hello, Senator. So I do believe with you that the Democrats now have a lot of very positive things to run on. The problem is, for 25 years, the Republicans run on fear, misinformation, and lies. And they have an amazing way of taking Democratic accomplishments and putting a negative spin on it, lying about it. And unless we as Democrats, unless the Democratic Party starts actually fighting back, I don't think the majority of people are going to buy in or even understand these accomplishments.
We got it, Rick. Let's hear what the senator has to say. Senator?
Yeah, I get it. I get it. The way I look at it is Democrats are actually good at government. They understand how the pieces work. They want to make it work, and they want to make it work for everybody. That's just kind of the heart of what they do. The Republicans are a lot better at messaging. They're better at calling people names, and they're better. And it's not to say they don't have some good ideas, although it's been a long time. Long dry spell. But I get it, and I get how frustrating it is when it feels like Democrats aren't out there fighting for it. However, can I just point out a couple of things here, Rick? Kansas. Yeah. And look, I don't care whether you're Republican, Democrat, or independent. The folks from AARP are a good example here. They're here because they've been fighting so that we had negotiation on drug prices, so that we got a cap on the cost of prescription drugs. And they've actually delivered. And they go out and talk to their members about how they've delivered, whether your members are Democrats, Republicans, or independents. And so I get it. I wish that we had more Democrats who were willing to wade into the fight. All I can say is when I ran for Senate, the gift that I got was a pair of boxing gloves for the reason of that is why I'm there. And I think there are more Democrats who fight in their own way, whatever it took. We have now delivered, And the power of that is we have shown it is possible to make change. Just say it one more time. The fossil fuel companies lose today when the House votes. Big Pharma loses today when the House votes. And those billion-dollar corporations like Amazon that have been paying nothing in taxes, they lose today when the House votes. Those are real things that we can get out and talk about. And maybe we need to find better ways to talk about them. Maybe we need to be more pugnacious about it. But by damn, we got real stuff that we've delivered, and I think that matters.
Rick, thanks for the call.
Elizabeth Warren is going to be with us taking our questions and yours until the top of the hour. We have a lot of questions on student loans. Here is one to you, Senator, and you and Ayanna Pressley, the congresswoman, and lots of other politicians have been working hard to try to do something about student loans. But this person says, I attended a college I could afford, obtained a degree while working hard for that goal and paying off tuition bills and debt all on my own without any government help. Now I must have been an idiot to have done that if you and many Democrats now favor student debt forgiveness. If the government moves ahead with loan forgiveness, I want my money back. Senator Warren, how do you respond to someone like myself?
So, you know, I might have said the same thing many, many years ago when I went to college, because I went to college that I could afford, and I paid for it on a part-time waitressing job. Only the difference was back when I went to college, it was $50 a semester. So my daddy ended up as a janitor. My mom worked a minimum wage job at Sears. Affordable meant a kid who could work a part-time job waitressing. Now, roll that forward a couple of generations, and now we tell kids more urgently than ever, you need post-high school education if you're even going to have a lottery ticket to make it into America's middle class. And yet, what do we say to them? You're on your own. So today, look at our public colleges and universities. How much of the cost are taxpayers putting in? Taxpayers back in Texas paid about 90% of the cost of getting me educated when I got my four-year diploma. Today, they're paying more like 25% of the cost, and the family is picking up the rest. And if you're born into a family that can afford that, good on you. But for the rest of America, education, instead of being a pathway up, opportunity opening out, for the Americans who aren't born into those families, it's loads and loads of debt. And what that debt is now doing is it is keeping those people from moving out of their folks' homes. It's keeping them from saving up to buy a home. It's keeping them from starting small businesses that would help all of us. It's even keeping some of them from starting their own families. And keep this part in mind. 42% of the people who have student loan debt do not have a college diploma. Let that one sink in for a minute. These are people who tried. God bless them. But pregnancy, trying to work three jobs, somebody got sick. So they end up with college loan debt, but they're earning at a high school level. What does that do? What kind of an America do we want to be? We want to say, listen, don't try to get more education. Don't try for that job that requires certain credentials, unless you're 100% sure you can make it, because the cost of failure will be enormous. Is that the America where we build a strong future? And let me do just one more quick one on this. On racial equity in this country, we've seen the numbers. We've seen the black-white wealth gap in America. Education was supposed to be our opportunity to help close that. The problem we've got, because the cost of college is so high now, is that African-American families, Latino families, borrow more money to go to school, borrow more money while they're in school, and have a harder time paying it off when they get out of school. I'll give you just one stat on this. 20 years after you left school, the median white borrower owes 6% of what they originally borrowed. Dang, 20 years, and they still owe 6%. But the good news is the end is in sight. The median black borrower owes 95%. What's happening is that higher education, instead of creating more opportunities, is becoming another divider. Born into a family that's got money, you'll do fine. Higher ed will put you on the course. Born into a family that doesn't, you're going to start the great race of life with rocks in your pocket. You're going to start the great race 100 yards behind the starting line because of the debt you've got. The single most powerful thing the President of the United States could do to help close the black-white wealth gap, to help close the Latino-white wealth gap, to help give us more gender equity in the United States would be to cancel $50,000 of student loan debt. Mr. President, it'd be a great day to do that today.
But he's not going to do that. All reports suggest he's going to do $10K if he does anything. I assume that's what you believe is about
I haven't given up.
But that is what you believe is going to happen.
I have not given up.
What do you also say, quickly on this, what do you say to the kid who's about to start?
Yeah.
Let's assume the student loan program forgiveness goes through, whether it's at the $10K level or the $50,000 level. The next kid's starting after the loan forgiveness. What do you say to him
Perfect
or her?
Perfect question. So the student loan debt cancellation is about the past and just trying to help get folks together, help get people on an even keel. Part two is, what are we going to do going forward? And the answer is income-determined repayment plans. So this is a plan where, in effect, the United States government says to somebody who has to borrow money to go to school, tell you what, we'll go into partnership with you. You want to go to school, we're all for that, we'll lend you the money to do it, and then when you get out, we're going to have a set period, let's say 20 years, and for that period of time, you're going to have to pay a portion of your income. In other words, what you pay is not based on how much you borrowed, because think about that. You probably borrowed more if you were poorer, right? It's going to be based on how much you can afford to repay. So if you're only making a little bit, you only pay a little bit. If you're making a lot, you pay a lot. And at the end of 20 years, we're done with you. The federal government is not going to be your debt collector into your 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. We're going to back off. That means everybody can get there. Can I do one quick other part?
Do whatever you please.
But there's a third part. And that is, we got to talk about how we fund post-high school education overall. We got to put more public resources into our training programs, into our two-year colleges, our community colleges, our four-year colleges, because this is a benefit for all of us. For everybody who wants to do this, I did this all on my own. Understand this. When the returning GIs came back after World War II, we said, in effect, you can have college, you can have technical training, and many, many men, they were mostly men, took advantage of this. And what do we know about the money we spent? We know that for every dollar we spent on their education, we got $7 back in more taxes that they paid because they made more money. They also caused our GDP to explode in the 50s and 60s. If you want to build a future, invest in the education of our young people.
We're talking to Elizabeth Warren, 877-301-8970.
I believe we have Brendan at the Boston Public Library. Mike, Dewey, Annie out there that wanted to speak about interest rates, I think.
Do we or
there?
Don't we?
No. Oh, he's not there.
Well, why don't we have Brendan come up, and in the interim, we'll take a call. Alice, yeah. You're in Plymouth. You're on with Senator Elizabeth Warren. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Senator Warren, for being there. My question is about student aid. My daughter has a master's degree in social work. She was very lucky that her undergraduate degree was paid for by her parents. She now owes $180,000 in debt for her graduate degree. She has been working for 7.5 years at a very low-paying job for a nonprofit, under the impression that after 10 years of working this kind of a job, she would get loan forgiveness. Is this something that could possibly happen, or should she leave her low-paying job, get a better job, and pay off her debt over the rest of her life?
We got it, Alice. Thank you for the call.
God bless, Alice. You know, this is another reason why we have got to straighten out post-high school education. Do we really want Alice's daughter not to be a social worker? Do we just want to say, sorry, it takes a master's degree. You know, you have to. That's their basic credential. It takes a master's degree, but it doesn't pay high. And yes, here's someone who's willing to live on knowing she's going to have more modest money available for rent or for housing, every other part of it. But we also want to choke her with student loan debt. This makes no sense at all. So I'll give three quick answers to you, Alice. One may be, hold on, and let's see. Jim Browdy is giving me the stink eye over whether or not the president will cancel student loan debt, and if so, how much. So your daughter presumably would be very much eligible for whatever gets done in this space. Second one is the Department of Education no longer is under the control of Betsy DeVos. And they actually have worked really hard to try to make the public service loan forgiveness program to get the kinks out of it. Your daughter may be someone who will be able to take advantage of that. And I'm just going to be blunt about it because it's so painful. We also need to get some changes in the rules around bankruptcy for people who just simply have way too much debt relative to their incomes, and bankruptcy is the way they get back on an even keel. So all three of those, and let's see how they play out over the next month or two, Alice. Good luck to you.
We have a gentleman at the mic. Can you tell us your name again? Walk up to the mic.
Good morning, Senator Warren, Jim, Marjorie. My name is Brendan.
Hi, Brendan.
I had a question about student loans. I know you guys had a lot of talk about forgiving at least a portion of the balance, but my question was about the interest rates. I don't know if you got a chance to see, but last weekend, Yvonne Abraham at the Boston Globe had a really great article about this issue with a bunch of data on how those rates are so high. Some are 8-9%. This is double what some people are paying on their mortgage. And can anything be done to keep the interest rates at 0% as they currently are? I just wanted to say that I've been out of school 10 years right now. My principal balance was $170,000. So far, I've paid $84,000 in payments. Of that, 80% has gone towards interest, and only 20% has gone towards the principal.
Right.
So that's my question.
Brendan,
okay.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, Brendan. So Brendan is not a plant. We never met before this day, right, Brendan? Okay, you and me. Literally, the first bill I introduced in the United States Congress after the good folks of Massachusetts sent me down to Washington was to change the interest rate on student loans. And the way I wanted to change it is say, how about we invest in giant too-big-to-fail banks through the Fed discount window by lending them money at what was effectively at that moment zero. And I said, why don't we invest in people trying to get an education in the same way so the interest rate would be pegged to exactly the subsidy we are giving to these giant banks. Now, it was a little cheeky, but it was also quite honest on this point. It's the interest rate that's just killing people. By the way, when I did that, that was so far out on a conversation about student loan debt, I couldn't get a single co-sponsor on it. Yeah, that's where we stood. But that also identifies where the problem is. I keep talking to the president about canceling student loan debt because legally he could do that. He can't change the interest rate. That's Congress. So I'm all for it, obviously, Brendan. I will dust off my early version of this, but we got to get rid of the filibuster, and that's a bigger question, and get our Democrats on board. But yes. I love it.
You know, Senator Warren, speaking of interest rates, not about student loans alone, but you argued in a piece in the Wall Street Journal that these rises on the interest rates were triggering possibly a recession, and you wanted Congress to do something. What should Congress be doing?
So here's my concern. We've been talking a lot about high inflation. And by the way, I'm not hearing the Republicans talk about the fact that inflation was flat this past month. But it's too high overall for the year. I get that we're worried about that. The Fed comes in and says we're going to do historic rate increases, basically three of them right in a row. Never happened in the economy before. And Larry Summers says that's great because it will cool the economy. And I just want everybody to hear this in English. What cool the economy means is that companies will retrench on their hiring, on their employment, and a lot more people will be out of work. We will drive up the unemployment rate. Indeed, Larry Summers said the best way to get rid of inflation here is to put the unemployment rate at 10% for a year. So that's what we're talking about. That is the Fed's medicine. The problem is, what's causing this inflation? Well, part of it is Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine, which has driven up energy prices. Part of it, we're still paying for COVID in the sense that we're still getting shutdowns in different parts of the world that mean you can't get materials and supplies. We've got problems in the supply chain. We're still getting kinks there. And frankly, we've got a bunch of giant corporations that have enough market dominance that they say, hey, everybody's talking about inflation. Okay, I'm going to pass along my costs, but, you know, while I'm at it, I'm just going to take another big spoonful of profits. And in fact, that is exactly what we're seeing, that the biggest players not just passed along costs, but that their profits have gone way up because they have increased prices. Now, here's the problem. The Fed can raise interest rates and get people laid off, but they can't do anything about those other things. It's kind of like you walk into the doctor's office and your leg is broken. You don't want a doctor who just gives you antibiotics. You actually need to deal with those problems. My push was Congress needs to be dealing with these problems, but in the meantime, the Fed better be damn careful as they keep ratcheting up interest rates if they're going to trigger a recession caused when we force people out of work, when companies start retrenching on hiring.
Your best buddy, that's my Larry, concern. Your buddy Larry Summers says 3 out of 4 chance there'll be a recession. Do you agree with him?
You know, I don't. Not now. But the Fed could trigger one. And that's, to me, the single biggest risk right now is if the Fed is overzealous on raising those interest rates, another historic raising interest rates, and you really could take this economy and tip it into a recession.
That's the voice of Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's going to be with us till the top of the hour taking our questions and yours. You're listening to 89.7 GPH, Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. By the way, we timed it, Senator. We're joined by Elizabeth Warren for this whole hour. We timed it. That was the longest an elected official has ever gone without taking a breath. You just know, seriously. The Guinness people just called a couple of minutes ago.
I'm glad.
If you want to talk to her or text her, you call 877-301-8970. We'll try to take more questions from the floor as well. Can we go to a text question? Senator Warren, when Roe was first overturned, obviously, Dobbs case, there was a recommendation going around suggesting the Hyde Amendment be overturned to allow abortion to take place on public lands. Forget the Hyde, the public land thing. That was you, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Was you, right. Regardless of the state they're in, your thoughts, please.
So, look, let's do the first part, and that is if we can get rid of the filibuster, we can actually make Roe versus Wade the law of the land. And that's what we need to do. I'm just, everything else is third best, 10th best, 15th best. And let's be clear in terms of what's at stake. Mitch McConnell has said if the Republicans can seize power, they will ban abortion everywhere. And that includes in Massachusetts, it includes California, Illinois, every place. So that's the big fight. The question under what can we do, should we do? Look, my view on this is we should be doing everything we possibly can. And one of the possibilities, for example, is a dispensary on federal lands because state law would not apply. Another one is to get rid of the restrictions that we have right now on access to medication abortion. A third one is to make certain that the federal government, who is a huge employer, is willing to pay travel costs and give people time off if they need to travel to another state in order to get the full range of reproductive health care services. But I really do want to underscore on this. As much as I'll work on every piece of what we can do, I will. The ultimate is we've got to get rid of the filibuster. That's going to take 2 more Democratic senators, hanging on to the ones we've got in 2 more, and hanging on to the House. If we can do that, and John Fetterman, I'm looking at you. Mandela Barnes in Wisconsin, I'm looking at you. If we can do that, We can get rid of the filibuster. We can make Roe the law of the land. We can also protect voting rights. We can do gun safety. We can do universal child care. All the dominoes start to fall.
One last thing, though, we mm-hmm. would not require, at least with the filibuster sure. in place. Your colleague, Senator Baldwin, I believe, is 3 votes short of getting to the 60, from what I've read, for same-sex marriage to be legislated in light of the Clarence Thomas threat in his dissent in the Dobbs case. Will there be 10 Republican votes to
I don't know, and I genuinely don't. I had lunch with Tammy just a few days ago. The answer is maybe. But I want everybody to hear this bill is a little more modest than it sometimes gets described.
Meaning what?
It is not an equal marriage bill. It is a bill that says every state has to recognize the marriages from other states. Mm. So in the half of states that still don't have equal marriage, this doesn't help folks. Now, good for folks here in Massachusetts. We've always been the leader in this. But we get rid of the filibuster. What I want to see us do is equal marriage across the board. I think it's the right thing to do.
You know, Senator Warren, you mentioned when you came in some of the things that the good stuff that's happened from the Democrat perspective, the CHIPS bill, the burn pit bill, which
yes.
I think was everybody's perspective, even though the Republicans are blocking it for a while, and the so-called inflation-reducing bill. So do you think that these things, plus the Kansas surprising vote in Kansas in support of abortion rights, is going to matter enough to get those extra senators you talk about in 2022? I mean, there's a lot of concern about that, the Republican complete takeover.
You don't get what you don't fight for. But, yeah, I think we are in this fight. Look, I think we're looking good on defending our senators who are up. Anybody who wants to door knock this weekend, I'm sure Maggie Hassan can always use some help. I think Kelly's looking good. Reverend Warnock, one of my beloveds, sits next to me, right? We sit in the same row on Senate floor. I think at Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada. So that would keep us at 50. And then all we have to do is pick up two people who say they're willing to get rid of the filibuster. And Pennsylvania is looking good. Wisconsin's looking good. And people tell me Ohio's in the fight and North Carolina's in the fight.
I assume you heard. I know you care about climate change. Herschel Walker's analysis of climate change was so thoughtful. Let's go back to the calls. Diane in Fairhaven. He's running for the Senate from Georgia on the Republican side. Diane in Fairhaven, you're on with Senator Elizabeth Warren. Hello.
Hello. Senator Warren, first of all, thank you for being a rock star. I've met you several times through my union, 1199 SEIU.
Go 1199. All right.
I know. And at UMass Dartmouth in here in South Coast here, I had to sign my t-shirt like a rock star. So you may not remember me, but you're always in my thoughts.
Thank you.
Anywho, how do I get through to apathetic women and their men who love them to get on board with getting the Democratic Party in power? Without sounding political, I don't get into politics. I consider it government. What can I say, Elizabeth Warren?
Okay.
These people.
So, first of all, we can't afford apathy. The next time I hear one person say, oh, I just feel so discouraged. I say, really? Is that what you're going to say to your grandchildren 10 years from now? You're going to say, you know, there was that moment where two more senators and hanging on to the House could have put us in a position to protect voting rights for all American citizens, to make Roe the law of the land, to give us universal child care, to actually make an investment and start to bring down the cost of housing. We were just 2 votes in the Senate and holding on to our House away from doing that. But you felt discouraged. You just felt tired. And so you didn't get in this fight. And now we live in a country where our democracy has been tossed out the window, where it's no longer who gets the most votes or who gets to vote. That's what you're going to say 10 years from now. You were too tired or too discouraged. I'm sorry. I've got no patience for this. What is on the line now is our democracy. How many people said in 1776, you know what? It's just too hard. I'm serious. How many people said in the Civil War, dang, you could get hurt out there? How many people have said during the 1960s, during the Civil Rights Movement, you know, it's painful. And besides, it's hot in the South. People said this fight matters. And Roe matters. The right to vote matters. Climate change matters. Having giant corporations run our company matters. We need to be in this fight. And that's not political. That is hanging on to our democracy. So go after him, Diane.
Diane, thanks for your call, as always. 877-301-8970 is our texting and phone number. You've been pretty harsh with the Republicans.
Not harsh enough. Bring on the harsh, baby.
I am pretty good at math, Senator. Mm-hmm. When you said we need two more seats, you actually have 50, plus the Vice President of the United States. So let's talk about two of those seats. When you go home at night and you're not giving a speech and the press is not going to be there, what do you say at home about a senator from West Virginia who, as the price for signing on to this inflation reduction bill, made sure that a pipeline that contributes to him got approved, and a senator from the Southwest made sure that some of our biggest contributors were protected from having their taxes raised above the level that their lowest paid staff were paying. What do you say about Sinema and Manchin?
I say that if we can get two more senators, it just won't matter.
Fair enough. 877-301.
I think we have some more people at the homie mic.
Do
we? We have Delia, we have Scott. Are they there?
They're coming. Oh, hi. Who are you?
Hi, my name is Delia Cabe.
Hi, Delia.
I'm a person of color, and as you look around here, I'm wondering, Senator Warren, how we could get more persons of color. I'm a Latina Asian. How could we get them more involved in the Democratic Party and also more engaged in events like this?
Mm-hmm. So it's a great question, and part of the answer has to be we got to walk the walk. And I think of walking the walk in two ways. I think of it in terms of the issues we talk about and connecting those issues up. It's why I at least had a chance to do it, for example, on student loan debt, which has profound impact on racial equity. But the second part of walking the walk is who actually gets these jobs. It's important to me who works in my office and who's doing the outreach on the ground. It's important to me who gets elected in this state. It's important to me to be out there for candidates of color, for candidates who will bring diversity. And I want to say on this, if I can, I want to stretch it into one more point, and that is judges. I'm doing everything I can to push our judges through. When we talk about diversity, it's important to have diversity on race, it's important to have diversity on gender, but it is important to have diversity on lived experience and professional experience. We need judges who have actually represented not just giant corporations, but real-life people.
Do you mean like Judge Nancy Gertner, who just walked in, for example?
Yes,
is that what you're talking
there
about?
There she is. Perfect timing. The chair of our Judicial Search Committee here in Massachusetts. Thank you, Nancy. But that's my best answer, Delia, is that we just need to make it happen, and we need to make it happen on all fronts, and I hope you'll partner up with me in doing that.
Delia, thank you.
Warren, we have the first woman of color as the mayor of Boston, Michelle.
Yes.
We used to work for you. So
she used to be my student.
Yeah, what'd you teach her?
That's right. I got to tell you, though, I don't think she needed many lessons on being tough.
How's she doing?
I think she's doing great. I think she's just doing fabulously. Do you think about what was handed to her and how much running room she had? One day she is running a campaign, then there's election day, and then like she's getting sworn in an hour and a half later and has picked up what? The education system, the transit system, the housing system. How many problems is she trying to deal with? And I think she's doing a pretty darn good job. I'm there with Michelle.
What's your name? Oh, good. You're the question we wanted to go to. Emily, welcome to the show.
Hi,
you're
Emily.
All with the senator.
Hi, Senator Warren. Thank you so much for taking my question.
Sure.
I'm an elementary school teacher.
Yes.
In this area.
Oh, let's hear it for elementary school teachers.
Thank you. And I have to say that we are all suffering from compound exhaustion.
Yep.
And I know that a lot of policies are locally done by school districts, but is there anything that Congress and Senate can do to help retain and support teachers through this unprecedented time?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. So let me just do a couple. I'll run through my grocery list, and Jim will make fun of me for never taking a breath. Okay, here we go. First one actually is student loan debt forgiveness. The Boston Teachers Union, the Massachusetts Teachers Association have been very strong with the national unions as well, getting public service loan forgiveness straightened out for teachers and for other public service workers. So that is a piece and matters a lot to younger teachers who have had to borrow more money than older teachers have. So that's part one. But part two is we put a lot of money into the first rescue package that we pushed down to the states for getting schools open. And when we passed that, more than half the schools in the nation were closed. Today, it's effectively at 100% are open. Now, there have been a lot of other things, obviously, that have happened as well. But we relied on the states to get it right. I think the question we're going to have to address very, very soon now is how we get the resources into our public schools in Boston, in Worcester, how we do it in Springfield, and how we're going to do it in towns out on the Cape, how we're going to do it out west, and whether or not we're going to continue to try to rely on local funding. Because the consequence is, again, just to keep starving our school systems. Now, Massachusetts has done a better place than most for spreading some of the money out so that schools get better support. It's why we end up with rankings number one in the country in terms of our performance. But it's not nearly enough. And I'm just going to put a small pitch in. If we passed a wealth tax in America, we would have enough money to fund pre-K, to fund universal child care, to do much better funding of K-12, to handle cancellation of student loan debt, and to do post-high school education for everyone who wants it. And that's how I think we have to think about our future. We just passed this gigantic CHIPS bill. Good, CHIPS, and as I like to call it, CHIPS and science, because it's got four times as much money that's just going into basic science research. And here in Massachusetts, hometown industry. This is really good and important stuff. But we did this on the argument. I listened over and over on the floor of the Senate as people kept saying, yeah, we really got to invest in manufacturing in America. That's how we build a future. How about we invest in our kids? Because that is how we build a future. That's the priority I want to see us on. Thank you for your work. Thank you.
Thanks for your question, too. So, Senator, a couple of people text about one of your colleagues, and I'll sort of combine the...
You want to tell some secrets?
How many times have you watched the video of little Josh Hawley running away from the January 6th? Tell the truth. Raise your right hand and tell the truth. Come on.
All I can say is it never gets old.
Senator, on a very serious note, Marjorie and I talk about this a lot on the show. We're CNN fans. We watch every night. When you see images of what's going on in Ukraine, and I know we're doing a lot, we are lay people. We don't know anything about foreign policy. We just know a lot of pain is being visited on a lot of courageous people. And I think I speak for Marjorie that we share a frustration that we're just not doing enough. Are we?
We could do more. And I want us to do more. But I do want to say the way I think we need to think about this is the Ukrainians are fighting for all of us. They're not just fighting for their homeland, and bless them that they are, but they're on the front lines against a big country that thinks it can just invade and take what it wants. And they are fighting for all of Europe. They are fighting for us. Asia is actually engaged in this now. Russia is watching what's happening. So we've had to walk a line, and I want to give the president credit. He does not want to get us into a direct conflict with Russia. Nobody wants to trigger World War III here. It's important to have someone who's sober and calm. But it's also important to acknowledge that the Ukrainians cannot be left alone in this. And we are doing more now. I sit on Senate Armed Services, so I want to say this at a very high level. We're doing more with training to use more sophisticated weapons. And frankly, we're also discovering holes in our own weapon system in the sense of supply lines, that we shoot a bunch of things and it turns out we can't get more. So part of what is so frustrating about this is trying to get all the pieces working well. But the Ukrainians have taken everything we've given them, everything that the Europeans have given them, and they have used it to fight back on behalf of all of us. And I'm 100% behind them, and I'll stay there.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
I think we have time for one more call. Lois in North Grafton, you're on with Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Hey, it's got to be quick, Lois.
Hi, Senator Warren. I'm calling. Thank you for taking my call. I am calling about Social Security. I keep reading about the Democrats wanting to increase it by $200 a month, like immediately raising the cap from the $147,000 per year on salaries.
Senator Warren is cheering, Lois. You can't see her, so but continue. Go ahead.
Okay, so I wanted to know if you really, the Democrats are really working on getting something going to, and then that the fund would be funded until, I think, the year 2090. Can you tell me what's going on with that?
Yes.
We have a minute, Senator.
Okay, so I'm going to do this really fast. So sure. This is something, Bernie Sanders and I are the Social Security caucus. Mm-hmm. And our big pitch on this is that we need to shift what the curve looks like. That is, people of more modest income, we need to bring that up. And we also need to ask people at the very top on income to pay more. We have a Social Security taxation system that's set up exactly backwards. The poorer you are, in a sense, the more or lower wage earners are going to pay more. So Bernie and I want to attack both halves of that. This is a paid for, very responsible, but that gets more money into the hands of people who have to count on that Social Security to support themselves. Here's the good news, Lois, and that is ideas in Congress especially take a long time. It's very rare that you get to come in on the first day. I think they're great ideas. Come on, guys, could we just get this done? But like the interest rate on student loans, that was 9 years ago when I started. But we've gotten a lot of those loan programs straightened out now. There's been billions of dollars of loan forgiveness just this year, and we are about to move to a place, I hope, where the president's going to do something more, and we're going to revolutionize this area. We are now pushing hard on Social Security because it's the right thing to do, and I've just been played off stage. Hang in there, Lois.
Lois,
we're going to do
for
this.
The call.
Senator Warren, thank you very,
thank
very
you
much
so
for
much,
being
Senator.
Here.
We really appreciate it.
We very much appreciate it. Mr. Warren's time. And coming up, retired federal judge Nancy Gertner is here to make sense of the FBI search of Trump's residence and the warrant that both Trump and the DOJ want released. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. I think I said fudge instead of judge. It's Judge Nancy Gertner.
We got the concept.
Thank you.
On Boston Public Radio, live at the Boston Public Library, Attorney General Merrick Garland has announced the Department of Justice is seeking to unseal the FBI search warrant of Mar-a-Lago, and Donald Trump agrees. Retired federal judge Nancy Gertner joins us. Then GBH's own Brian O'Donovan, Boston-based chamber group Neve Trio, they join us ahead of next weekend's Rockport Celtic Festival, and they'll play. Then it's drag performer Patti Bure sharing how her drag queen story hours have been targeted by recent neo-Nazi demonstrations.
The art world is reproducing Greek and Roman statues in all their original vivid colors. GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen shares his thoughts on this, plus a new movie directed by local actor B.J. Novak. Then this year's sales tax holiday is about to begin. Regrettably, I spent $250 on a new microwave yesterday, but for those who are smarter shoppers than I am, anything you got your eye on, that's ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He is too rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday and every Friday from the Boston Public Library. We welcome all the people that came down here today to see Elizabeth Warren and Judge Nancy Gertner and our other guests later today, our musical entertainment later today. We are streaming on YouTube at youtube.com/GBH News.
And we also a couple of programming things. Next Friday, Mayor Wu will join us at the library for an hour. And Thursday, back in Brighton, the governor will join us. And I assume we may play that sound from Senator Warren to see what his reaction is to what she had to say about the tea. So search warrants, as we've all learned, typically are not made public. But according to Merrick Garland, the AG, the search of former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate could demand unprecedented transparency. Joining us now at the BPL to discuss the escalation of the FBI's investigation into whether Trump took classified documents out of the White House, who entered the library the second, as if on cue, that Senator Warren mentioned the judiciary, is retired federal Judge Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner is a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and a BPR contributor. Judge, it's good to see you. Thanks
good
for being here.
Good to be here.
Thanks.
Yeah, great to see you again, Judge Gertner.
I sensed my name was being said.
That's right. Yeah. So there was a lot of talk before Merrick Garland spoke yesterday about whether the Department of Justice should do what they don't usually do, which is talk about an ongoing investigation. But he did talk about this ongoing investigation, at least in broad terms. Was that the correct thing to do?
Oh, I think it was brilliant, actually. The other thing he did, I think that his talk was delayed, and I think his talk was delayed because he wanted confirmation that the motion to unseal had been filed. So he could get up there and say, we're not talking out of school. We're talking about what we have filed in court, and that then restricts what I'm talking about. And that's perfectly legitimate to say, here's what we filed in court, and then he could essentially talk about the investigation a little bit.
But as I understand it, even if we do see this warrant, it's not the warrant that's going to have all the details. It's the affidavit, is that correct?
Right. The warrant, the critical document is the affidavit that says, here's the probable cause to search this place, and here's why we believe a crime has been committed, and evidence of that crime will be there. That's a very delicate document. You all want to see it. I'd love to see it. But that also could disclose classified information. It could disclose sources of the FBI that they may not want to. And that doesn't ever get disclosed unless the defendant challenges the search, and that would be after he or she is charged. So it's never disclosed at this stage. The warrant is the directive that affidavit produced. The affidavit said, here's why we want to search this place. The warrant says, here's the four corners of the place we need to search. The warrant, though, does have, people are talking about it as an inventory or receipt, which will list what they found in general terms. So we'll know a lot about what was there from the receipt to the warrant, which that's going to be published. And the warrant may well also list the crimes that they're investigating. And we know from reporting that the crimes that they're investigating are the inappropriate taking of presidential records and maybe classified information. But if that classified information is nuclear secrets, then it would also implicate the very strict regulation of atomic energy secrets. That's separately regulated. So we'll know by the statutes that they're citing what they're interested in. It won't be as much as the affidavit, but we'll know a lot.
So if they were, in fact, as the Washington Post reported, seeking nuclear weapons, we'll have some indication of that from the warrant.
They'll say, here's what we think this crime will be. And if that's a crime that is implicating nuclear weapons, that will be a separate statute.
I have a couple more questions about the warrant.
Did I do that on one breath?
Like Warren does. I want to talk a little more on the warrant and the receipt. First, when the subject of the warrant, in this case Donald Trump, says it's fine with me that it be released, I assume it's 100% that the magistrate will say yes. The question is just how much is released. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely, because the issue with release when you have an uncharged defendant is, what if the guy is never charged? What if the guy is acquitted but never charged? It's what happened with Hillary. It's what Comey did to Hillary, which is releasing an investigation which then pilloried her without her ever being charged, let alone tried. So this is a very delicate point, and defendants usually don't want this stuff to come out, and it wouldn't have come out unless Trump had had said there was a search.
I want to revisit, though, what you were saying to Marjorie a minute ago about what we're likely to get. I think I speak for Marjorie here, that she has great fear. What that great Peggy Lee song, Is That All There Is? The fear is that the people's sense, anticipation builds up a la Mueller, and then, really, that's it? It's possible, this is a question, not a statement, it's possible that we can learn a lot less than you're saying we'll know. Is it not possible that Trump's lawyers, despite his bravado, are going to go into the judge when the judge is deciding whether or not to release this thing and try to narrow the scope of what's released to the public as possible?
They may try to do that, but I don't think so. I mean, either this is public or it's not. So, as I said, it will be a warrant to say we're going to search the following places. And we're looking for the following things.
What does that mean, things? Things, documents he took, or these specific documents?
No, it will talk about documents that are might say documents that on their face suggest that they were classified. It might be presidential documents.
I see. Okay.
It will be, the thing is that the warrant sort of maps onto the affidavit, and the affidavit is very specific, and the warrant, ordinarily the warrant and the affidavit could be attached, not in this case. But the warrant will say generally presidential records, classified information. The new reporting is that it might say, atomic energy secrets. Mm-hmm. And then it will list the statutes that map onto it. It won't tell you specifically. I mean, it could be an atomic energy secret that was a portion of a document, mm-hmm. and really no big deal. But the statutory references will tell us what they're looking for. Your concern, though, was my concern when this whole thing broke.
Which is?
The overreach.
That's right. I mean, yeah. If essentially it was, Trump, you took this memo and you shouldn't have. And it was neither classified nor atomic energy, it would have felt like a Mueller diversion. It could have been, but people have to realize that the Presidential Records Act, particularly for a president that doesn't use email, is actually incredibly significant. Yeah. What he does and what he was doing and to whom he was speaking will be in memos. So it doesn't even have to be classified information. It will be in memos.
Judge Gertner, obviously you were a judge. You were a federal judge for quite some time. I wonder what you think. We have this federal judge who signed this warrant. He's now facing death threats. Apparently his temple is worried about having Shabbat services because of some kind of violent attack. But there has been not only threats against different judges, but the Supreme Court, as you know, the faith of the people is down to, like, I think 38% as of July, a precipitous dive after Amy Coney Barrett arrived. So these attacks on the judiciary are another part of the thing that scares people in terms of the demise of democracy. Why is it such a big deal that we have faith in judges?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated – it's an easy question and a complicated question. The easy question is – that the judges have no army.
Yeah.
We had no army of our own. That was a famous historical statement, and that essentially the people will follow what judges say and what courts say because of the legitimacy of the institution. And when that begins to erode, what does that mean? Well, it means people will not come to court when they should. You know what it will mean? It will mean the Steve Bannonization.
Yeah.
Of all court proceedings. I don't have to go. I don't have to listen to you. And so given the fact that so much of the judicial system relies on trust and legitimacy, it makes a big difference. It also is an impediment to people wanting to be judges. I had been a pretty out front lawyer before I became a judge. It was very difficult to hide where I lived, particularly giving press conferences on my porch. But it will keep people from wanting to be judges, that's troubling.
Can we talk about that for a minute? I don't mean this facetiously. I'm pretty sure you took a pretty big pay cut you were a big-time criminal lawyer, as I think most
right.
people know. I'm sure most federal judges are established enough in the community that most of them are having to make that sacrifice to begin with.
Yes.
Last night, after you were on CNN, I think it was after you were on CNN last night with Anderson Cooper, he interviewed Judge Salas, whose son was executed, was murdered at the door of her house, and her husband injured. And, it's sort of analogous to the most moving testimony I heard in the whole January 6th hearing. The mother and daughter, who are the election workers, whose lives were ruined, and this woman said, we can't go anywhere, we can't do anything. Right. Why would somebody who has an option, their career, say, I'm going to go into a profession where if I do something that the extremists in this country don't like, they're either going to threaten me, maybe kill somebody in my family. And by the way, this was not right-wing and extremist. I should be clear with Judge Salas. It was a litigant who was a lawyer was really unhappy. Why would the average person say, I'm willing to put my family at risk, myself at risk, while I'm also losing a significant percentage of income?
Because the job is amazing. Because there's something incredibly wonderful about going out on the bench and trying to do justice. I mean, I can't say it any other way. The job is amazing. From the from the courtroom where the baby is crying, and I would say, you know what, I'm used to talking through baby crying, and you can have the baby crying, to the decisions that my clerks used to call intergalactic decisions, which were the decisions that actually made a difference. So yeah, the job is an amazing job, and if money doesn't drive your life, and it never drove my life, then you want to do it.
But now, there are going to be people, and I don't mean even to disparage them. I'm not sure if I was qualified if someone said, if I'd say I'm willing to put myself at risk. There are going to be people who are going to drop off because it's just not worth the crap one has to take in this violent environment.
Right. It's not just, I mean, the violence is one thing. The marshals protect judges.
That's a great way to live with marshals. Right. I'm serious.
Right. But I mean, you know, you have to be exposed to, obviously, criticism. I mean, criticism today looks very different than criticism 10 years ago when I was on the bench. I mean, criticism, which is, you know, I mean, the social media has sort of changed the civility of that criticism. Yeah, that's hard. But it's, as I said, the rewards are astonishing. And they're personal rewards. And there's, you know, a body of work that you thought that you actually did some good.
Glad to hear that.
We're talking to Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and was a longtime lawyer, as Jim pointed out, a defense attorney. Put in context for our listeners the former President Trump having taken the Fifth Amendment over 400 times in a civil case in New York State involving allegations of his inflating the worth of his property and then deflating them when it came to tax problems. Where does that fit in, 400 times plus taking the Fifth?
Well, I mean, I have a lawyer's response, and then I have maybe a judge's response. The lawyer's response is, boy, those lawyers must have been relieved. Boy, those lawyers. Can you well imagine what he would be like if actually let to speak? He's under oath, and then you let him go on. The lawyer would have had a coronary. So that, to some degree, the Fifth Amendment was actually something that was good for the lawyer. And in a civil case, I think people have reported this, in a civil case, when you take the Fifth, you have entitlement to take the Fifth, and certainly he does because of the incredible criminal liability lurking there for him in numbers of fronts. But when he takes the Fifth in a civil case, at the subsequent trial, the questions that he took the Fifth about will be deemed admitted. So, I mean, you can imagine, you know, did you inflate the values of your properties in order to get a loan? I take the Fifth. Well, at a subsequent trial, that'll mean the answer to that was yes. So it undermines the presentation on the civil side, but he's making a calculation that his criminal liability is way more important to him than whether he winds up with civil liability.
I mean, in fairness, if you were his lawyer, you would have urged him to take the Fifth Amendment.
I would
too,
have
would
insisted
not?
Or not, I wouldn't, or I would have quit.
Yeah. And by the way, just to be clear, the two concerns are, one, he would incriminate himself, and two, he'd commit perjury because he is sort of a pathological liar,
right,
which is another criminal offense.
That's right. That's right. No, I actually felt relief for his lawyer understanding that he was taking the Fifth.
You know, we were reading this morning in the New York Times, I forget who wrote the piece, but talking about how, back to the nuclear weapons thing, that there was so much concern about the president blurting something out or telling people top secret things that they, the Joint Chiefs and other people that were briefing him on these sensitive issues, wouldn't give him the full story out of fear, which is a pretty scary place for us to have been.
Which is scary. I mean, there are the things that he did that violated norms. We know about them. But that's something else. The notion that the military would not be fully candid with the chief, with the president, because they were afraid of what he would do. That's very frightening going forward, because you don't want them to be able to do that with other presidents who are obviously more tightly wrapped than he is.
You know, by the way, I saw you on CNN two nights in a row. And
I will be on tonight.
Three nights in a row. Okay. And when asked why the president did this, you said it was irrelevant, and maybe that is. But I'm certainly curious about if he did, in fact, take all these documents, anything nuclear. I am curious.
Well, explain why you said what you said about the why.
I said that, and I actually changed my mind as soon as the camera went off. So here's what I said, and here's what I wanted to say. For the technical violation of classified information or the presidential records, it doesn't matter why. It only matters that you did it. But we also should be concerned about the why. The notion that he would have intentionally taken records from the White House on the day that he left, okay, that could have been, maybe that wasn't intentional, maybe that was inadvertent, you sort of swept it up and right. It was in there. But then there were two subpoenas in which the government said, hey, you have this stuff, give it back, and he retains it. And then now, for the search, he retained it still. Then you have to ask, it's not necessary for the crimes of the retention issue, but you do have to ask, what was he planning to do with this stuff?
Exactly.
There was an intentionality to the keeping of it, which is frankly chilling, particularly if this is in any way nuclear material. What was he going to use it for? To whom was he going to give it? What was he going to threaten? My God, that's the part. So I was right in what I said, but the broader picture is actually incredibly troubling.
Well, can I be totally irresponsible and speculate based on nothing except knowing Donald Trump from afar? One, to impress his friends, and I don't mean that as a joke, by the way, to pull out classified documents, and two, to get business for his kids and himself. I don't think there's any reason to assume that he would not be willing to share, let's be euphemistic, right, a document in return for a commitment to buy blank
right.
from Ivanka Trump. I don't think it's, at least to me, it's not mysterious at all. It fits a pattern with this particular man's life.
But that's what the past couple of months with the January 6th committee has actually shown. I mean, people characterize Trump as sort of, as the Russian idea was a useful idiot, that there was stuff he would do because he had no judgment, and these, you know, showing the Japanese prime minister at a dinner at Mar-a-Lago,
right.
Documents which in fact could reveal signal intelligence, he was doing it inadvertently because he was sort of a blowhard. But as I said, there's an intentionality about mm-hmm. the boxing up of documents, the resisting of the subpoena, or at least not being fully forthcoming with the subpoena, and now this search that does suggest he means to use them somehow, and that's very troubling.
Can we ask one more question about what the likely outcome is, which I know we're obsessing on this, but we are obsessing on this. I don't know Merrick Garland personally. I only know him sort of indirectly through TV and what you and Larry Tribe have said to me on television. He was obviously Tribe's student, like everybody on the planet. Apparently
not me,
was,
though.
And
right.
Nor I, but
yeah,
Barack Obama, Merrick right. Garland, two members of the January 6th committee, on and on and on. Roberts was his student,
Roberts
too.
Roberts was his student,
Chief
right.
Justice Roberts. In the political world, where I think Garland does not live, one would not seek a judge's permission to release the warrant and the receipt for what was taken if one thought that it was going to be an is that all there is kind of thing.
Yep.
But my sense of Garland is he's such a straight arrow that even if an advisor, a political advisor, said to him, there's going to not only be great disappointment here when there's not much there, but in addition, it will feed the Jim Jordan lunatics of the world in the Congress saying there was no reason for you to seek a warrant for this, quote, raid, as they call it,
right.
even though it wasn't a raid. Is that not a reasonable fear, considering the kind of person Merrick Garland is?
No, it absolutely is. I mean, I think the pressure to release the warrant was enormous. This was a way to do it in a lawful, in a lawful sort of cabined way by moving to unseal it. And you're right. I mean, I don't think that it matters to him that it's not going to show, enormous misconduct, or may not show enormous misconduct. It will hint at it. There's no question. If classified information, the statute is mentioned in the warrant,
mm-hmm.
then you know, then it will suggest that there's that he really did something. And as I said, he did something. It was not just I minutes after the camera was off, I wanted to say, you know, we were prepared to believe that the boxes in January of 2021 were sort of whoops. He was rushing out, you know, I'm packing to go to New Hampshire. I'm doing the same thing. God knows what's in my suitcase, right? But the year and a half, the 18 months in which people say, hey, do you know what you have? And he says, no matter. That's a whole different thing.
Judge Gertner, switch gears for a second. There's a much written this week about this 18-year-old young woman in Nebraska and her mother who are facing these charges in an abortion case that involves Facebook messages. This was a very late situation. This woman was 28 weeks right. pregnant, so that's beyond the Roe limits where you're supposed to be life, health of the mother, or some severe fetal anomaly. But what was scary to many people about this is that the cops served a warrant on Facebook and went through her messages. What's your take on this case?
Well, it's very troubling. Although we don't have trouble when Facebook is subpoenaed for the January 6th committee. We don't have any trouble with that. And Facebook subpoenas to Facebook. You know, asking for information is sort of a version of subpoenaing. It used to be toll records in you know, who you called, who you were calling, and from whom you were getting messages. So I don't think that Facebook has liability abstractly. But it does mean that particularly for younger women who live their lives on the Internet, they are exposed in ways that we never have. I mean, between Facebook Messenger and, you know, and even texting, I mean, that's very troubling. In this case, it looks like, and I don't agree with it at all, but they, I don't know how they found out about the birth, about the you know, she said that the baby was stillborn.
Yeah, when she was being interviewed by the cops, she was scrolling through her Facebook.
But the question was, how do they even know about the case in the first instance?
I'm not clear.
How did they know about the case? So she said it was stillborn, and then they wanted to find out when it was in her pregnancy. That would have happened pre-Dobbs.
Yeah.
That would have happened
pre-Dobbs. Because of the 28 weeks.
Because it was because of the... And it happened in Massachusetts. The people in the audience may not be old enough to remember. Ken Edelin, if you recall, was a doctor from Boston Medical Center, I believe. He did an abortion, and the district attorney investigated to see if the abortion... It was a nurse who claimed that that when the abortion was completed, the fetus was... you know, cried or something to suggest that it was alive, and he was prosecuted for manslaughter. So this current in our law has been going on long before Dobbs. Now it's enhanced by the fact that this is a generation that lives online. So the tracks will be there.
But here they're going after the woman, not the doctor or the medical professional.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right.
So put nothing on Facebook and email, text messages, TikTok, any player that you don't
want to be seen by. Or the app that monitors your menstruation, for example. Yeah. I mean, you know, that's the...
Well, you know, if I may interrupt, the one thing we didn't get to with Elizabeth Warren, one of the things she's doing, not statutorily, but through the power of the bully pulpit of being a senator, is reaching out to companies, two major ones of which... have agreed not to share location data, which is really, really important in terms of where a woman goes if she's seeking an abortion or reproductive advice.
I mean, but, you know, I mean, as I said, the tools of law enforcement have sort of bled over into the Internet and all of that, and that's already troubling. But when you add to that this incentive to get women who are getting abortions, then you have something very different.
Now, do you want to promote anything else you're doing other than CNN tonight, or is that enough for you?
It's the Anderson Cooper Show.
It is. Anderson and I are just like this.
He's great. That's the best show on CNN for my money.
Nancy Gertner, Judge, we really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much for being here. We've been speaking with former federal judge Nancy Gertner. We very much appreciate her time. Coming up, GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen joins us on BJ Novak's new comedy thriller, Vengeance, and a bunch of other art news. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, and we are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday and Friday from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming on YouTube at youtube.com/GBH news if you were not wise enough to be here. I want to say a lot. Some of you were here early and got to hear the rehearsal of this brilliant trio, the Neve Trio, who with Brian O'Donovan. They're going to be with us in about a half hour. And if you want to hear some extraordinary music on a beautiful Friday, I would urge you to stick around. First, ancient Greece may have been the cradle of democracy, but as we're learning from recent art exhibits, their taste in art may have been just as bold, with new art exhibits recreating ancient Greece. This is unbelievable. And Roman statues, as scholars believe they would have been, painted opaque pigments covering the subtle and elegant lines of muted marble. Joining us to discuss is GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen. Hello there, Jared.
It's great to be with you both.
Thrilled to have you.
Okay, Jared Bowen. Now, I must say, I'm not an art critic like you.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But I was kind of horrified to read
all
and
these
then
years.
Saw these like, pictures. Can people see these on the...
Well, actually, Rob, who's directing this, is about to put them up.
I mean,
thank you, Rob.
That down at the Met in New York City, that they're... Look at that. They painted over these, what was muted marble and kind of grays and whites and off-whites, into these weird
colors.
Well,
they didn't paint on the original
statue. Well, I know, but that's the exhibit, isn't it? What's going on down there?
Yeah, what's going on, Jared?
Exactly.
Come on.
I think it comes as a surprise to a lot of people that when you go to ancient Greek galleries and museums all across the world and you see the pure, pristine white marble, it wasn't created like that. We know that now.
I didn't know that. It was highly
painted and decorated.
Oh, that's terrible.
No, it's not. Well, can you imagine being out in a world where everything is just white and clean and pristine?
But did you see those? I mean, look at this. Well, this is just ridiculous.
You know what they've done? You're talking about this because there's an exhibition at the Met right now. It's called Chroma, Ancient Sculpture in Color. But the Museum of Fine Arts here has done this as well, and you'll find this in their new galleries, their Greek and Roman galleries. And they've actually done a lot of examination with the latest technology that's available to even be able to sense the sense of pigment that was on these statues. And there's one in particular. You go up to her, and you can actually see the traces of color if you look closely enough. And so you get a sense of how highly decorated things were, just as they are today. So there wasn't this notion of we have to have perfection in complete whiteness.
Did you know this before this recent spate of painting these images? Did you know that these things were not in muted colors?
It's scholarship that has developed over the last, 10 years, I would say, so I was aware. And you'll probably also be interested to learn that for the longest time, I haven't been there in a while, but the Old North Church, the interior, at least when I was there on a field trip, was completely white, but that wasn't completely white either. There was marbleized wood and columns and faux-painted wood, so that was highly decorated too. So there's a lot of examination now, especially with the technology that's available to go back and look at what it was. Marjorie's going to be horrified that the Parthenon was not the Parthenon.
Look at the look on her face.
Well, okay.
You get that?
I this is kind of like your tacky little sister or something. And the headline for
they
the
are
Washington,
really tacky looking.
Very
actually.
Tacky, very tacky. The headline in the Washington Post, I'm not the only one who thinks this, is what if the ancient Greeks and Romans actually had terrible taste? And that's how you feel looking at these things, right?
Well, art is subjective,
So art is subjective.
I think it would fit well in Las Vegas.
Look at this gilded gold. Yeah. I mean, really.
Or Mar-a-Lago, one.
Mar-a-Lago, exactly.
That is actually a very good one. Or the penthouse at Trump Tower, wherever the guy lives.
So just one last thing about this. Jim just asked for this, but I'm not sure I understand. So we knew this a while ago because of the leftover bits of paint. And just over the years, it just kind of disappeared?
Yeah, because, of course, they're thousands of years old.
Yeah.
And so so much of it was out in the open air for so long, and they weren't repainted. And so there was a lot of pushback when the scholarship first developed because people really didn't want to I guess they were the Marjories of the art world. They didn't want to accept that this was actually the case. But, yeah, they know for certain now.
So this stopped in the beginning of the Dark Ages or something? Or, I mean, this did not continue?
It did continue, but, of course, it's been washed away. And, I think then notions of...
like Michelangelo's David or anything like that.
Well, I can't say for sure, but no, I don't believe so. And Rodin, of course, when he was creating...
Why don't you believe that? Why? Now that I think about it, and Marjorie's sort of worked into a frenzy here, but maybe appropriately...
I've never read anything that suggests his were...
Okay.
I mean, and he was more about classical beauty, which I think at that time was defined as just absolute purity and color.
Yeah.
Okay, so speaking of changing the image as we knew it, can you describe this Faneuil Hall thing that is going on that is really pretty dramatic?
Neat.
Yeah, so if you go to Faneuil Hall right now, just beyond the Bill Russell statue, so if you go to City Hall, you can see the Bill Russell statue, and then walk down the steps, and you'll see this massive portrait in front of Faneuil Hall. And if you get closer to it, you realize that suddenly you're looking at Faneuil Hall, but without anything in front of it. So this is a sculpture, or this is a piece of public art by the Colombian and Boston artist Juan Obando. Mm. And he has frequently looked at this notion of what public art means. We've talked about this a lot, not necessarily that it's public art, but as we've taken statues down across this country, looking at what Confederate statues represented in the South, you know, what is the place of public art? Where should these statues be? So when you look at this picture, massive, massive picture. I think I have the dimensions here. I think it's 20 by something, 28 feet wide, 16 feet tall. And I should mention that this is presented by the Public Art Group Now and There. You don't see the Samuel Adams statue that's in front of Faneuil Hall.
Very clever.
What's also very clever is, as I approached this and I was looking at this and I thought, wow, it really does change the landscape, in part because it brings you this purity that we were just talking about. Suddenly there's nothing on the plaza. It's just this blank space, so more pedestrian access. I know that's where a lot of the acts happen to, you know, acrobatics and stuff, the street performers that take place down there. But as I was standing there, there was another man talking to a representative. And then that representative from Now and There came back over to me and started talking to me. And I thought it was just a really invigorating conversation because, of course, being a journalist, I turned the tables on him to ask what people's notions are. And he said it's kind of split evenly between people who think that history should remain intact and presented to us versus people who think, no, these pieces should be carted off and make a space for new artists, new performers, new statues.
I think it's just fascinating. I got to get down there and see that myself. It's really neat. So I want to talk to the Peabody Essex Museum. We always rave about
it because
it is a great place. It's small enough that you're not like totally overwhelmed when you get there. Plus, they have a really nice lunch place you can eat inside.
They just expanded though in the last year. We haven't seen the new wing. I haven't been there since. It's about a year, right? Is it about a year?
I think it's been a couple of years.
Okay.
Now.
Yeah. Okay. Since pandemic. Okay,
yeah. Good. Well, I think I've been there because it's all glassed over, and it's a beautiful spot. But anyway, this looks fantastic. This is Patrick Kelly's Runway of Love up there. Tragically, he died very young. He was
35.
35, yeah. Back in 1990 of complications of AIDS. But what a fantastic... Explain this great exhibit.
So this is really an excavation of a fashion designer who just came into his own and somewhat quickly in terms of getting international renown. And then I think because he did die in 1990, he was only 35, the fashion world moved on without him. And so he was to some degree forgotten, and this changes that. So we find this exhibition of a number of his runway fashions. And he was a man who was just completely filled with joy and happiness. He grew up in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and he grew up having this affinity for fashion, basically for a few things that he saw. One, what his grandmother did and how she sewed and how she would replace buttons, but they might not have matched. So there were these colorful buttons that she would put on clothing, and that becomes a staple of his clothes. You see buttons everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's very, very colorful. But also, he said there's no greater fashion than going to church on a Sunday and seeing all of the women dressed up and in their hats. So he moves out of Mississippi, he was a black man, he goes to New York, starts working, doesn't necessarily get traction until he's encouraged to go to Paris, starts making fast fashion on the streets, and people really take to him. And within just a couple of years, he gets a major profile in the fashion magazine, and then he gets a multi-million dollar contract, and then he's off. And then the AIDS crisis hits, he develops AIDS, and as you say, dies of complications from AIDS. But in the time that he was working, he had huge attention. He was dressing Grace Jones, Betty Davis, Madonna.
Yeah,
I mean, he had people
Grace Jones and Betty Davis?
Isn't that just
That's
amazing?
That's quite a twosome, I should say.
You know, I've seen their other fashion exhibits up there, and you get right up next to these amazing dresses and from different eras, and it's really worth a trip. It's only about a half hour away or something like that.
Oh, you know, Jared, as a professional as you are, what do you think about the fact that when Margie holds up an image, she not only doesn't hold it up to the camera, she doesn't hold it up to the audience,
okay.
She holds it up
okay,
to
there
you.
It is.
How valuable? Oh, there
good?
It is.
Yep,
that's
there
actually.
It is.
Well, now the audience can see. Well, hopefully it's a tease to go see it all in person, too.
Yes.
And I think it's kind of funny because you have this
thank
notion.
You.
Ooh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob, for
nice
doing
time.
A close-up. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
And then for all the people driving right now who have no idea what we're talking about. But you have these conceptions of what the 80s design is with the big dynasty shoulder pads, and he was not that. I mean, he was very just about accentuating the woman's body and then, again, finding play and joy. And it's a lot of fun to go up to that show right now.
So many of us were big fans of The Office, where we first saw B.J. Novak. Then we saw him in different productions, and then we read his short stories, which are really clever. Now he's got a movie.
Is he a local?
Yes,
he's a local
guy,
right?
Newton or something?
Went to Newton South High School.
Oh, he did? Okay.
Newton South High School, okay. But they kind of got panned in the New York Times, but I hope you don't think it was bad.
Actually, I'm truly shocked. Of course, when I'm seeing movies or shows, I don't read anybody else because I don't want it to influence what I'm doing. So I'm shocked because I saw this film and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. It is such a great distillation of this moment. So he wrote this, directs it, and stars in it. And he plays a New York intellectual writing for The New Yorker, very proud of who he is, but not quite moving to the next level of success, which apparently in this age is you have to have a podcast or you're nobody. I think we're seeing this.
Oh, Jim, we have a podcast.
We do?
Yes, we do.
We do, actually.
Yes, we do. Yep, that means we're somebody.
Podcast,
I'm sorry, Jared.
Sorry.
We'll work on that next year.
I actually read this week, maybe it was this review by A.O. Scott, there is no white man in America who does not have a podcast. That was
one of the points, but go ahead.
So he plays this man trying to get to this next career, and then in the middle of the night he gets this phone call from somebody in Texas who tells him that his girlfriend has died, and he doesn't know really what he's talking about. He's telling him, B.J. Novak, that his character, the girlfriend has died. He has no idea what he's talking about. Well, come to find out, there was this woman who did, in fact, die of a drug overdose in Texas. She thought more of the relationship than he did. So
he was just the love of her life, and she couldn't quite remember.
He couldn't quite remember
who she was. They hooked up a few times. By the way, we have some sound from this.
We do.
Before you go on with the story. Here's a scene from... Well, maybe you should finish the story.
So I'll just say before you... I don't know what the clip is, but so then he decides, well, maybe I'll go to Texas and investigate why she died, and I'll turn this into a podcast. And you think of intellectual New Yorker going to a red state thinking he's more intellectually impressive than anybody he's going to encounter, and then we can talk about the rest on the
other
side.
But doesn't he figure in a kind of crass way that having a dead girlfriend that died of a drug overdose is going to somehow catapult him into the level of podcasterhood?
Well, I think one of the great lines in the movie is the holy grail of podcasts is a dead white girl. So, yes, he sees a lot of opportunity in this.
Okay, so here's a scene from Vengeance, and in which journalist and podcaster Ben Malenowitz, played by B.J. Novak, calls his podcast producer Eloise to pitch a story.
I have a story. Can it wait?
No, I'm in Texas. I'm on my way back from a funeral.
Oh, my God, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. It's not someone I was close to.
But you flew to Texas for it?
Yes. It was a girl I hooked up with a few times.
You flew to Texas
to attend the funeral of a random hookup.
Her family thought that we were more serious than I did.
You know what?
This is a story.
I don't like him that much without Steve Carell myself. You know, can I ask you a question, not about this, but about something you said? I don't have the confidence when I go with you, for example. We're at
Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, that's a good example. I was going to mention the Neil Diamond thing, but a beautiful noise.
Yeah.
And I wasn't 100% sure how I felt about To Kill a Mockingbird, so I waited the next morning to listen to your thing on the radio and to read reviews to decide how I felt. I mean, it's pathetic, but it is. Do you really not read any?
No.
You don't even want to be informed by other people's perspectives? No,
not at all. One, because I'm
afraid.
Aren't
you worried you're going to look like a dope when everybody says something is horrible? I'm serious.
I used to. I think
you don't anymore?
Maybe far enough into my career that
I still worry about. He's a man of confidence.
Well, I wouldn't say 100% confidence, but I think more confident. No, my main fear is theft. I don't want to read something and take somebody's concept.
Actually, that's a very good point.
Because I think. Isn't it strange how you'll read something or you'll see something and it just tucks into your brain and then you use it later? And even sometimes you use it and you think, well, that doesn't really sound like me. I wasn't that clever or original. So I live in fear of looking at somebody else's material and then doing that.
Well, speaking of that, I don't know if you were listening to the show the other day. This is unrelated, but it's related to what you just said. I have told the story on the show. We've been on the air 25 years together in different stations. I have told I have told the story of living in New York City, putting a piece of cheese out on my counter, turning the lights off, and turning them on 60 seconds later to see if the cheese was covered by cockroaches. I'm sorry it's disgusting, but it is
revolting.
Okay.
Because everybody's having lunch
so
here.
I'm on the radio with Marjorie about 2 weeks ago, and we're talking about bugs that freak out people. And Marjorie said, I lived in Providence, and when I lived in Providence, I'd put out a piece of cheese, turn off the lights, and see how long it took. I said, no, you didn't. She said, yes, I did. Yeah. I said, no, I did in New York. You didn't do it in Providence.
I think I did.
She still doesn't admit
it. I didn't do it in Providence. I did it about two blocks from here.
Oh, my God.
In the back bay.
You didn't do it anywhere. Margaret, you didn't do it anywhere.
I did. I remember smashing them.
That's the problem you're worried about, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
I thought when I was a kid as a Boy Scout, I had to put out a piece of cheese. And
oh, you did it too.
It was.
Maybe it was you I heard it from.
We all did the cheese.
Here's what I think. I think when you have cockroaches, it's kind of like a game. Everybody puts out a piece of cheese to see how long the cockroaches
will be.
Trust
me, you didn't do it.
Swarming all over.
Okay.
And then you come out and you kill the cockroaches. What did you kill the cockroaches with?
Usually like a cast iron pan or
something
like that.
Yeah, cast iron pan. That's what it did. It was really
disgusting.
Wake up all
the neighbors.
Yeah, exactly.
Disgusting.
Okay,
anyway.
Who is Leslie Dill?
Leslie Dill is. I just want to go back to the other thing I loved about because I thought there was a through line for vengeance.
Oh, vengeance!
This notion that you have to do a podcast because it's all about the commodification of death and crime. And I just started because of the TV critic we speak with. I just started watching Only Murders in the Building, and there's all this rage now around podcasts. But this is what it's all about: is it's just you're building on people's misfortune and stories, and that's why I also think that this is such a great movie for this moment. It's also a dark comedy, I should say.
If you didn't see Only Murders in the Building, Martin, what's his last name?
Martin Short.
Martin Short is trying to make a podcast out of murders in the building where Selena Gomez and Steve Martin also live, and it's pretty entertaining.
People love murder mysteries, though, don't they?
Well, this is what got me thinking, because then I thought, well, this is nothing new, because Truman Capote did it, of course, with In Cold Blood, and that really made his career. And he did the same thing. He was this New Yorker who travels to Kansas to go explore this story.
And, you know, when I was a reporter, I loved covering murder trials. You didn't want them to be horrible, like with children or anything.
But, why?
Because they were just fascinating. What's fascinating is that you see the defendant in the courtroom, and usually they're in a suit and tie, and you look at that person, and you can't imagine that this person did what they're accused of doing, and it just undermines your sense of, do you really know anybody? I mean, it would be the husband killing the wife or the husband killing the family member or something like that.
I always thought, because I covered a few murder trials as well earlier on in my career, and I always thought the same thing. It was so hard to sit in that room with for that reason, and you think, well, I can't understand this, but then you're thankful that you can't understand it. But it is hard to reconcile how there could be this horrible situation, then you see this person sitting a few feet away.
The only reason I'm laughing is you're unbelievable. I mean, not only did you steal the cockroach story from me, Marjorie is saying she doesn't like murders or grisly that involve kids. How many times have you talked about the murder where the guy puts his wife's head on the stick in the backyard?
Well, that was bad. No, he didn't put her. He didn't put her head.
Yeah, I'd say that. I would argue it'd be pretty bad.
No, it was her heart and her lungs.
Oh, my goodness. That's fine.
And this is an unbelievable one. He was called the ZD Killer.
I remember. This is exactly what I mean.
Herald, and the reason they called him the ZD Killer
Why is that?
Because that was alleged. He obviously had some mental health issues.
Oh, you think I did?
His wife overcooked the ZD, and he killed her.
Yeah.
And drove around. It covered in blood in the neighborhood, and the neighbors saw him covered in blood, and that was a gruesome one. Yeah. But you know what? This was not a murder. Well, it was a murder. But the most fascinating one of all, in terms of that, was the Charles Stewart case, because you think she was married. Carol DeMatteis Stewart was married to him. She was expecting a baby, and that she apparently had no clue that her husband was going to shoot her.
You know
in
who
the
represented
head.
Charles Stewart's brother?
Yes, I do. Nancy Gertner.
Nancy Gertner, before
she
was a federal
Matthew
judge.
Stewart, and Matthew Stewart is the reason that a innocent person did not go on trial
exactly
for that,
right,
because Matthew Stewart had a pang of conscience. Remember, Charles Stewart had Matthew Stewart come up to the Brigham Circle, right behind the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and pick up the jewelry so that it would look like it was a robbery. And Matthew Stewart had a pang of conscience and told Nancy
Gertner.
And then Nancy Gertner reported it to the correct, or I don't know how.
She was a lawyer then. She was not a judge.
Yeah, she was a lawyer.
I can close the loop on this.
Please.
I've told you this. There was a murder in the house I grew up in. After we moved, this man murdered his wife. I think it was his wife in my parents' bedroom. How awful is that to drive by your house and see that and know that that happened there?
Can I tell you what's going to happen? I would listen to the show for 6 months. In 6 months, Marjorie's going to say, there was a murder in the house I grew up in. And then she...
Okay. I would like to say, I think I have you beat.
What?
Because my aunt.
Oh boy,
up,
here we go.
Oh, this is a good one, actually. This
She's
going to
use the Lizzie Borden story.
She is.
Yes.
That's exactly right.
You've heard it before.
No, tell it.
I was making the Fall River connection.
It was. She Maplecroft was my aunt's house, and it was not the house in which Lizzie Borden gave her mother 40 whacks, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. Yeah, she killed her mother first, and then, stepmother, actually. But it was the house.
Thank you.
It
not
was
right
the
now,
house
please.
That they moved please. To after the murder was Maplecroft, and we would go up there at Thanksgiving and look for the axe in the house.
Oh, boy.
Isn't that great?
Very rich childhoods.
Actually, can I tell you something? It was my aunt. So it wasn't, actually. Before you go, we're running low on time. I asked you who No, it's not your fault. It's Marjorie's fault. No, I'm only kidding.
It's always my fault.
Who is Leslie Dill?
Leslie Dill is a longtime artist who has this really interesting show on view at the Canterbury Shaker Village in New Hampshire right now. It's on view through September 12th. And it's called Wilderness Light Sizzles Around Me. She is somebody who's always been rooted in textile and language and words and poetry. A lot of her career, she will tell you, has been inspired by Emily Dickinson. But what she's done in this latest exhibition is, over a number of years, she's created a number of characters through fabrics, people like Mother Ann Lee, of course, for the Quakers in Canterbury Shaker Village, and Sojourner Truth, Dred Scott, John Brown, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Hester Prynne, so some fictional characters too. But she takes language and embroiders that.
I love this.
Both in banners.
Great.
And so creating portraits of people with their own text and how she's distilled it across the clothing. So you, and it's very, very distinctive. She has a very, very keen visual vocabulary. And so you walk through this encountering all of these figures and really forcing yourself to dive into their sentiments. And it's called Wilderness because she looks at these characters who have come out of some sort of wilderness, whether it's Mother Ann Lee and being so progressive and founding this community, or, of course, people like Hester Prynne. So it's a very, very engaging exhibition there. And it's beautiful, beautiful grounds at the Canterbury Shaker Village.
Did you interview them?
They had her on open studio.
Okay. They have a lot of the furniture there, too, right?
They do. Everything is beautifully painted, and the rolling green hills, and the very simple furniture.
This Armenian thing, art, can I wait till next week? It's not going to close before.
We can talk about it next
week. Okay, fine. Let's do it next week.
We got distracted. By cockroaches.
And murder.
And murder. Thank you very
There's
much.
There's my podcast. Now I have a podcast.
That's right. Of your parents' house. Murder in the bedroom.
Yeah,
there we go.
I like it.
We've been speaking with GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen.
Thank you very much, Jared Bowen.
Up next, we're going to talk to Boston drag performer Patty Bure. She's going to fill us in on these recent neo-Nazi demonstrations in Boston and how they have threatened hers and other people's safety, including the children who are there at the libraries to listen to the drag hour. Anyway, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Tuesday and Friday, from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie are live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. We're about 20 minutes away from the Neve Trio. You're not going to want to miss them. They are great. When Patty Bure joined us at the BPL back in June, I think it was, she was in full colorful drag. And we highlighted the importance of Drag Queen Story Hour. They create a safe space and awareness for kids to learn about difference and respect and all those kinds of things. And apparently they're just downright fun as well. Well, Patty is back, looking a little different today. After recent horrible neo-Nazi demonstrations in Boston that have threatened her, others' safety, and possibly shuttered these events altogether, Patty Bure, it's great to have you back. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Patty, for coming in. So tell people who don't know about these story hours, what's the deal? What happens at them? Who shows up at them?
Yeah, so I've been saying this week a lot, like, you don't have to be a neo-Nazi to not know what Drag Story Hour is. If you don't have young kids right now, if you don't live in the kind of communities that invite me to come, you may never have experienced something like that. Although you may have experienced a show like RuPaul's Drag Race, or you may have gone to a drag brunch, in which the style of performance is very different. You know, it's geared towards queer people, it's geared towards adults who are drinking, out having a good time. But Drag Queen Story Hour is an event that is geared specifically towards kids, mostly, usually under five. So it's a storybook reading, there are songs, and I do it, and the folks that I work with come in drag. So that can mean, like last time I was here, I was wearing a blonde wig and, you know, a rainbow dress. Although I feel like the shirt qualifies.
You look very well today. You look very well.
Thank you.
You know who also does this? Our buddy Ryan Landry does this on the cape as well.
Yeah.
So why? What's the goal? I mean, I touched on a little bit in the introduction because I learned this from you and Ryan. Why do you do this? Who comes? What's the concept? What's the mission?
So the Drag Queen Story Hour, the story hour element is geared towards promoting literacy in kids, like any story hour that they have been to, whether with a teacher or librarian. And the drag element, and this is where it gets people, is about promoting self-love and self-expression. That's what drag has brought to me, being part of the Boston drag community. And we hope that it shows kids the same thing, that you can imagine whatever kind of life you want for yourself. Because drag is never about, a lot of people think of it as about being a man who is dressing up like a woman because that's what you see a lot on TV, but drag can be anything. It can be dressing up like, you know, any kind of crazy character you want to imagine. So that's
what I think the other thing too you think about, I mean, a lot of kids have parents who are gay or trans or non-binary or whatever. They themselves at 3 or 4 or 5 may be thinking that maybe they are going to be gay. Or, I mean,
or they're straight and they go to a kid, go to school with a kid or a parent of a kid.
But it's to me, it's like widening the horizons of these children. And if they are children, parents, gay, whatever, that they're going to feel more accepted in their own skin.
Absolutely. I think another aspect is, like, I've never sought out this work really specifically. I've always been invited in. And I think that these families, you know, or the libraries or the, you know, businesses that invite me to come want kids to see that queer people are safe. They're part of the community.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
let's talk about safe for a second. I assume everybody in the audience here and listening, wherever they're listening, knows about what happened in JP and the Seaport, but some may not. Describe what happened in Jamaica Plain.
Right. So in Jamaica Plain, I was doing a story hour, one of these events that had at the Lauren Greenough House. It had already been rescheduled because we knew that there was a possibility for protest. I mean, this has been going on all summer. And as long as Drag Story Hour has existed, there has been backlash to it. But it's become a lot hotter in recent months, literally and figuratively. We got through this entire event that we had rescheduled so that there could be plenty of people outside welcoming people in and, you know, keeping watch. And as I was, you know, finishing, I was getting my stuff together, ready to go. A group showed up with a big banner, which had, you know, some, I'm not going to, like, repeat what they were saying.
It's disgusting.
And they were loud and they were aggressive and they were yelling at the families and the kids who were leaving, you know, before me. Luckily, I was able to get in a car and get by them without them really noticing me. However, I forgot my ukulele. So I had to, when I got home, I had to go back. And I'm really glad that I did forget my ukulele because when I came back, both sides of the street were lined, one side with this neo-Nazi group and the other side with community members from JP who saw what was going on and mobilized really quickly to say that there is nothing about what they're saying that represents their community and get out.
You know, by the way, I had dinner in JP the next week and there was another wonderful counter-protest outside the school, which was terrific. The most important thing you said there, Patty Bure, I think, I hope people heard carefully, is it's not just directed at you, which is bad enough, and your colleagues doing what you're doing, but little kids whose parents took them this thing are getting screamed at by these extremist sadist types who are with these disgusting signs.
And they're professing that the reason that they're so concerned about Drag Story Hour is for the safety of the kids.
Exactly.
But they were, the kids and the families were the only ones who were yelled at. They didn't, you know, weren't even able to find me because they don't know what a drag performer is. Or what they're looking for.
Well, also, the way they look to me, I mentioned this before we went on the air, is kind of scary because these are men. They're, a lot of them are young. They're masked.
Right. And I said to you, it's probably the first mask they've worn.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's a very good line there.
We're doing it during... Well, they're full of them, Jim.
I'm full of them.
Wearing like COVID-style masks, when I think of it. They're kind of like these big masks.
Yeah.
They're intimidating.
They are,
and there's a
yeah.
large number of them. How many were in JP?
I would estimate like 25. Again,
yeah, 25
like
is
I
a
was
lot.
Trying not to see them. So in the seaport, I did end up. I never actually got to that event because I did end up calling it because just based on the venue that particular event in the seaport was in, I just didn't feel like I could safely get into the venue without inciting further aggression and violence from them. And so the families were able to leave, you know, safely, but I was worried that my presence, you know, I was already fully in drag, that it could create a situation that was not good.
So does that mean no more? I mean, why not no more? I mean, why not the next time you have one scheduled? Why would you assume that the, and by the way, Wu to her credit, Mayor Wu, who's going to be here next Friday, mm-hmm. called them cowards because of the mask. That if they're going to do what they're going to do, which is bad enough, not even having the courage to show who they were sort of adds to the insanity of this thing. But why are you not worried this is going to come to an end?
Yeah, I'm unwilling to have what I can and can't do as an artist in Boston be hemmed in by professed neo-Nazis. It is scary. They are intimidating. Otherwise, I wouldn't have canceled the event. They do have a history of physical violence. So I'm in a process right now of, you know, talking. A lot of people have reached out to me, you know, anti-fascist groups, groups of parents who have experience confronting groups like this head on, who want Drag Story Hour to continue either for their kids or just because they feel the same way that I do, that, you know, these are not people who we want deciding what we can and can't do in our city.
You know, one thing that was heartening, we should do this first, then we'll get to what I consider to be disturbing but maybe unavoidable. Rachel Rollins, the U.S. attorney, was on my television show the other night, and she announced that day.
He is moving like a truck.
No, that's the wrong sound, but thank you anyway. That would be Secretariat. We love Secretariat,
Rachel?
Too.
Rachel? We do.
Rachel did sound different there, didn't she?
She did sound different.
She's on my show, and that day she had announced a hotline called the End Hate Now hotline. Here she is talking about how it works.
Mm-hmm. What happens, Jim, is that we start saying out loud 1-8-3 End Hate Now, and we start making sure that that is something I'm saying a lot when I'm speaking in the community or with members of the media, and then people have to call. And we will be notified. I personally will get a notification when somebody leaves a voicemail message, and we're going to field that information out to the appropriate entities as we see fit.
Well, let me repeat that. It's 1-8-3-END-HATE, and hate is H-8, the number 8. Now, that's the good news, and I think I read in the Globe yesterday or this morning that a couple of dozen calls have already come in, so people know about the hotline to do it. The bad news is, and I know you know this, is that much of what these people do is First Amendment protected. So as intimidating as it is and as terrorizing as it can be, in most settings, it appears that law enforcement can't do anything. Does that trouble you?
It absolutely troubles me. And she did reach out to me this week to tell me about
Rachel Rollins?
Yeah,
oh,
Rachel
great.
Rollins reached out to tell me about the hotline, which was not something that I was aware of. And I, you know, I think that their heart is in the right place with that policy. However, when I come to these events now, as the last two have stood, it's a line of police officers and a line of, you know, neo-Nazi demonstrators. And that is not a scale that feels in the balance of my safety. So I've been doing a lot of learning this week from people who have a lot longer history of confronting these white supremacist neo-Nazi groups head on, who are, first of all, organizing a march on the 2nd, the Fight Supremacy March, which will be outside the police headquarters at Ruggles. And what they're asking for is an investigation to the police involvement with these groups, because we know that there is overlap. So when I see a line of police officers and a line of white supremacists, that's not something that makes me feel safe, and I feel like calling that hotline is what would result in.
Well, you know, just to interrupt you for a second, for those who may feel it's a little bit of an extreme statement about the police, Rachel Rollins herself, several weeks ago, after the Patriot Front marched through Boston, said a similar thing when she turned to the media and the people who were there and said, I think we have to, I'm paraphrasing, we have to answer the question as to whether or not this was a Black Lives Matter protest as opposed to a white supremacist protest, if the police would have handled this the same way. And I think most people agree how the police handled at least that demonstration was wholly inadequate. There was virtually no presence. We're talking about Patty Bure, who is responsible for these wonderful drag story hours.
You know, when I was reading in preparation for talking to you today, Patty, I read that these story hours have gone on for a while. So what is it now? Is it Donald Trump? Is it, you know, just the Charlottesville residue from the, you know, Jews will not replace us, tiki torch rally down there at the beginning of Trump's term? What's going on?
Right, and there is a direct line between the creation of this New England-based group that has been coming to my events and Charlottesville and the attack on the Capitol. Why now is just because these groups have been allowed to put down roots and to feel comfortable. There are policies in other countries that do not protect neo-Nazi speech under a free speech kind of law. So I think that while an end hate, you know, number is all well and good, we need to go further than that.
You know, Patty, I'm totally on your side. I hope you know that. But the difference between us and them is we have a First Amendment. And that does create, I was going to say, a problem. It's an important thing that isn't a problem, but it does create a barrier to enforcement. So if you're worried, as you should be, even though you say you're going to continue, about a continued presence, I was about to say to you, but then I stopped myself. Mm-hmm. So how do people find out about the next drag story hour if they want to come and bring their kids? What do you do to get the word out so that you're not harassed and threatened and that sort of thing?
We could do secret advertisement for it. You know, we did that with the rescheduling of the event at Lauren Greenow House in JP. We tried to do that, and obviously it wasn't successful. So in any version of this going forward, there is risk. I'm currently rethinking the way that the Drag Queen Story Hour Boston organization kind of goes about booking events, which is instead of accepting invitations to, you know, put the production of the event in our own hands. So we're looking for, you know, a venue that is, if anyone's willing to host us out there, who would like to have a community-based drag event that is family-friendly every month, we would love to go there.
Then the next question that I'm nervous about asking you, how do people get in touch if they want to be that entity that provides a venue? Mm-hmm. What do they do?
Just put a piece of cheese out on your counter and turn off the light. And when it comes back on, I'll be there.
Okay. Another one.
Okay. Now, okay. Patrick, I bet you... Whoops. It's Patty.
That's fine. Patty. It's all
Patty, I bet you've had some experience with cockroaches in your life. Have you ever put a piece of cheese out and see what happens to? Is this not a common kind of game?
I've got a very friendly mouse who I do sometimes, you know, throw a piece of popcorn, you know.
But we don't want to crush the mouse, though, right?
No. Squishing a mouse isn't nearly as satisfying as squishing a Nazi.
If people do want to help or be in touch, in a, what are they? How do they reach out to you?
You can reach out to me on Instagram, which many neo-Nazis and well-meaning people have done this past week. Okay. So it's Patty Bure, PattyBourree, Instagram, Twitter, Gmail.
Hey, listen to this, Patty. This is from Emily in Medford. She says, oh, Patty, we saw you at Drag Queen Story Hour in June in Watertown. My daughter loved the event. We're watching, listening to you now on the radio, and she's so excited to see you. She still talks about you all the time and wants to know if she can be a drag queen if she is a girl. We love you, Patty.
Anyone can be a drag queen. It's true. There's all types of people who are drag queens. Drag is about self-expression and love, as I said, and it feels so good that that is the message that, you know, kids like that who come to Drag Queen Story Hour get.
Would you like to sing a few verses of Wheels on the Bus before you depart?
That's not really in my repertoire.
Okay. I could get, Wheels on the Bus, it was one of my favorites.
Me too.
Tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Oh, sorry.
I was going to
sing for you.
Give a few verses of that. I love
a few
that.
Verses?
Yes.
The whole song? Okay. No, it's all right.
I saw Barbara Streisand.
Did you really?
As a 16-year-old in Funny Girl before it went to Broadway.
Shush.
Exactly. I knew you'd be envious. Patty Bure, we admire what you do. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you,
Jim.
Good luck with this. Good luck.
Thank you for having me.
Heidi DeRay heads Boston's branch of Drag Queen Story Hour. We thank her very much for coming, and we're very sorry that the drag queens and these children have to go through all this. Coming up, a continuation of our Live Music Friday series continues. Ahead of the Rockport Celtic Festival, which you're going to hear all about, we're joined by GBH's Brian Donovan of Celtic Sojourn Fame. We're going to hear music from the Neve Trio. They're next, Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews. Live Music Fridays continues at the BPL on BPR. We're joined now by one of our faves, GBH's Brian O'Donovan. You know him as the host of A Celtic Sojourn on Saturdays on 89.7 and lots of wonderful events we're talking about. And the Neve Trio, who we've heard play, are spectacular. Cellist Misha Vezilov. Let's hear it for Misha. Pianist Ari Nakamura, and joining us over here with Brian is violinist Anna Williams. Let's hear it for Anna. They'll be performing for us here in a couple of minutes ahead of Brian O'Donovan's Rockport Celtic Festival. That starts August 19th at the Shailen Lou Performance Center up at Rockport. Yes, in Rockport? Is that where that is?
Shailen Lou?
Yes,
yeah,
in Rockport. Yeah. Welcome to both of you. Good to see you both.
Great to be here.
Well, it's not only in Rockport, but you always talk about the incredible place, the view and the water and all that. So tell us about the festival and what and the view.
Well, first of all, Marjorie, I've got to get this off my chest. The wheels on the bus go round and round, round and round, round and round. The wheels on the bus go round and round, all through the town.
That was lovely.
Right? How could we leave a suggestion for the wheels
Boy,
on the bus?
Boy, that Neve Trio can really sing, let me
well,
tell you.
That actually usually has a cello accompaniment, but we just didn't have it brought.
Opportunity missed.
It is Rockport itself, Marjorie, as you know, and most people know here. It's almost, I call it, an impossibly beautiful town up there on Cape Ann. And the good folks at Rockport Music raised funds and created this venue called the Shailen Lou Performance Center, which is probably, and I'm not afraid of exaggeration, as those of you who know me know, but it's probably one of the more beautiful venues in the entire world.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
It has a backdrop where, if the curtains are open, which they usually are, looks out on the harbor. And to see music being formed with that kind of a backdrop is really almost an existential experience.
You ever performed there, Anna, of the Neve Trio? Have you ever performed at the Shailen Lou?
Yes, this is our second time, and it's so exciting every time.
You know, we've talked to a lot of people of late. It was 2 weeks ago, Andres Nelson was with us talking about playing at Tanglewood outside. When you play and you're not in a hall, but at least a piece of the action is out in the natural world, doesn't that change the whole deal for you?
God, I mean, I think it's just a reminder of, like, this is why we're here, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, that it's just, we're just this small part of the whole experience. And I think we feel so spoiled when we're in those moments, because we feel like we're, you know, as immersed and as sort of like getting to take it in as everyone else.
Tell us about the Neve Trio, by the way.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, we're really excited to be here. I think I told you before, I'm from Boston and my parents, super supportive. They've never been more excited by anything that we've ever done than to hear that I was with Jim and Marjorie and Brian today. So,
well, wait a second. This woman I am watching almost had to be resuscitated when Elizabeth Warren walked in.
That is
that
also
true?
That is
okay,
also true.
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead.
That is fair enough.
Okay.
We're a piano trio. We love to do repertoire all the way back, you know, the sort of standard rep to living composers. We get to work with them a lot. We love to do interdisciplinary projects. We've done stuff with artists at Harvard, et cetera. Dance, you name it. Our name actually is a Gaelic word. It's spelled kind of funky, but the Gaelic word, Brian, I'm sure would know much more about it, but it means bright and radiant, but it came from this experience that we had, a very formative experience, where we got to play for a friend of ours who had taken ill, couldn't leave his bed, And we would come and play for him, sort of doing the least we could. And then in return, he would tell us stories about his daughter his life before he had taken ill. And his daughter's name was Neve.
That's great.
So it's sort of this reminder of, like you said, with the natural world and community at large, like why it's important.
Why don't you, Anna, take off your headphone, okay. Join your colleagues, because you're going to play in a minute, and Brian can tell us a little bit about this Celtic festival starting on the 19th.
The Celtic festival is really something that I started with a harpist who was a crossover artist. She went to the Berklee College of Music here. She's originally from Edinburgh in Scotland. Her name is Maeve Gilchrist. Mm-hmm. And largely the impetus behind that comes from the impetus behind a kind of a new effort that Tony Rudell has put together at GBH called GBH Music, and really emphasizing the power of crossover. So we like to think, Jim, and you've heard us, Jim and Marjorie, you've heard me talking about this before, is classical folks only like classical mm-hmm. music, Celtic music or Irish traditional music is only liked by a group, jazz is only jazz aficionados. We believe that there's actually a lot of interest if people are introduced to new music and new efforts. And that's what this festival is dedicated to, the Rockport Celtic Festival. So hats off to the people who make it happen up there at Rockport Music. Hats off to all the people at GBH who make it happen.
You know, before we hear the new trio play, there were touches of Scandinavian music, and I thought, I don't even know what Scandinavian music is.
Scandinavians don't know what Scandinavian music is.
They should come then, if
they
that's
should
the
come,
case.
Exactly. But Scandinavian music has a lot of commonalities with traditional music from Scotland and Ireland, particularly. Okay. And that's being explored more and more, and we're going to explore it, a lot of it, at our Rockport Celtic Music Festival. So we've got a group coming from the Nordic Fiddlers Block, called the Nordic Fiddlers Block, and they are from Norway, as you can imagine, Sweden. They've got one member who's from the Shetland Islands. The Shetland Islands off the coast of Scotland are as Scandinavian as they are Scotland, sharing a lot of the traditions and the musical types. So that's precisely, Marjorie, you hit on it, the type of exploration that we do. And we have the liberty to do it because of the support that we get at Rockport Music and all over Rockport and Cape Ann. So it's really a wonderful event for us, and it's a privilege for us to be able to have those explorations.
You know, as soon as the Neve Trio plays, you have to explain. This is like a wall-to-wall from beginning to end. There's something going on practically all the time. You should describe what that is in a minute. Do you know what they're playing, or should I have asked Anna?
I don't think they know what they're playing yet as well, but they certainly do. What are you guys going to play, actually? You should have asked Anna, but she can speak into that mic.
Can you speak into that mic? I don't know.
Does it work?
I don't know. Does it
work?
Yeah, it does. Say.
It does.
I should have asked you earlier.
So we're going to play two. I'm not sure if you're going to split it up or not, but we're going to play.
We are. Okay. Play one, talk, play.
Awesome. So we're going to play some Seasons.
Oh, nice.
Too bad Senator Warren left, because in homage to maybe continuing to have Seasons, we're going to play.
Thank you for that.
We're going to play two Seasons from Astor Piazzolla, Argentinian composer. So you might hear things that you haven't heard before, and I can talk about it later.
Fabulous. Thank you so
and
much.
And this is the equivalent of the Four Seasons, except in a different style. And Astor Piazzolla just is such an exciting composer and has left the world with this. I have cheated a little bit. I've heard this performed before. Hold on to your seats. Strap on your seat belts. This is Piazzolla at his best, as played by Neve Trio.
Here they are. Thank you. Woo! The Neve Trio on cello, Misha Veselov, violin, Anna Williams, piano, Eri Nakamura. Wow. And by the way, in case we forget, rockportmusic.org to get tickets. Anna, that was it was unbelievable. That was great, all three of you. Brian, tell us, this thing essentially almost never stops from once it starts on the weekend of the 19th.
Yeah, multiple concerts involved all the way through Sunday afternoon when we have kind of a crescendo, which we call Songs and Music of the Sea or Symphony of the Sea, which again celebrates that beautiful backdrop, celebrates where we are, the rocky coast of New England. But it really does what Neve Trio just did there, taking a piece inspired by one of the same seasons that inspired Vivaldi, without the Argentinian romance and spice thrown in there, courtesy of Astor Piazzolla. But essentially what we do, I only joked earlier on about them not knowing what they were going to play. A lot of what we do is spontaneous, Jim. So we gather these musicians and we see what happens. You know, they're top-notch musicians from around the world. And then we do strange things with Celtic music. We have the Celtic musicians there, but we invite Doug Wieselman, who is a bass clarinetist, world-renowned, to be our resident musician for the weekend. I have no idea what's going to happen. It could be fireworks. It could be
Maybe you should get your act together for the weekend, don't you think? Maybe.
Exactly. There are refunds available if people don't like it.
Oh, no.
So, Anna Williams, I have a question.
Sure.
I know you grew up in a family of Irish step dancers, and your mother was quite good.
How did you know?
Well, because I read about you.
Oh, my God.
And I'm Irish, and every time I see Irish step dancing, I hate to say, but I'm reminded, because there's no, it's all just the feet and the legs, right? And everybody's, I'm reminded of the nuns, you know, telling you had to have like 12 inches between you
also
and your.
It's very Irish.
It's
also.
Very, yes. Like, let's not have anything that's at all sexual. What do you think about that?
Of what? Wait, of
which? Well, it just always, I think we need a little bit more upper body movement in Irish step dancing, I guess, to come into the 21st
century. I
actually
love Irish step dancing.
Yeah.
Which I think I was exposed to through one of your deals. So you want to respond to that accusation?
Well, so I hear you. I totally get it. I'm not a spokesperson for the dance form, but I've also seen, I have seen it. I get what you're saying. When you see it live, though, the way in which the, like, it's as though you're flying. It's as though the dance is flying. And I think, in a, I don't know. I mean, as someone who grew up in an Irish family, so there's a lot of Irish dancing at weddings and stuff. So, but when you see it done really well, it's like this other force, you know?
Okay.
I don't know. I hear you.
You don't get flashbacks to Sister Mary Aloisi or anything like that.
My mom probably does.
So, Anna, before you rejoin your colleagues, other than on the weekend of the 19th when you were part of the action, this wonderful festival that Brian and his colleague have helped organize, how do they find the Neve Trio in other times?
Oh, well, we do have a website.
Which is?
NeveTrio.com.
N-E-A-V-E.
N-E-A-V-E. Trio. It's like leave, but actually don't.
Love that. You've never said that before, have you? I don't think
never.
So, no.
The first.
So you can take your headset off and go back to violin. What do you want to tell us before they play yet another season?
I want to tell you first that Marjorie needs help.
I do. On many fronts.
Many fronts, but especially around the Irish step dance.
Okay.
That's funny, Marjorie. But to camp on to what Anna said, Irish step dancing has been a little loosed from what you
expected. Has it been loosed a little bit?
No, definitely. It has river danced a lot of...
Yes, so river dance. So you can move your hips a little bit?
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
I think
only
within 2 inches.
Oh, within 2 inches, okay.
And leave room for the
Holy
Ghost.
That's
exactly.
Right,
gotta,
yeah.
Thank
do
you
that.
Very much for that.
But it is really, again, a privilege. I really appreciate your guys doing this. For our colleagues at GBH, there are many of us that absolutely love the news, love the hard news that you do, the hard debates. But GBH was founded on the arts, you know, to begin with. So having Jared here and having a commitment to music and programming, which again is happening at GBH Music more and more. Live music, it's where it's at, I'm known for saying. And isn't live music wonderful?
Yes.
This audience.
Three people are not applauding. You can leave now. Thank you very much. So we're going to hear from the Neve Trio again. I don't know if you're aware, it rhymes with leave, but don't leave. Have you ever heard that before, Anna?
That.
Don't leave. Thank you very much. The Neve Trio yet again. Welcome to the three of you.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with GBH's Brian O'Donovan, host of the Celtic Sojourn, which you can see here Saturdays, 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. on 89.7, and the Neve Trio, violinist Anna Williams, pianist Ari Nakamura and cellist Misha Veselov. They'll be performing at Brian O'Donovan's Rockport Celtic Festival starting August 19th, the whole weekend up at the Shailen Lou Performance Center in Rockport. And you can get your tickets at rockportmusic.org. Thank you so much, Brian, for coming in. And thank you all. That was such a treat. We must appreciate
great.
It.
You were really fabulous. Almost as much fun to watch, by the way, as to listen to. You really are great performers.
Exactly. Again, it's live music, Jim. There it is, great. You know, right in front of you, even if you haven't gravitated towards classical music before, or Celtic music for that matter. The mishmash is happening, Rockport Celtic Music Festival. It's on display here this afternoon. Thanks.
And Bill, you should have mentioned, they'll be playing Wheels on the Bus. I think it's Sunday night, so I can't wait to hear them. Yeah.
With that cello accompaniment. Can I just give a big shout out?
Sure.
We needed a piano for today. Give us a run on that to show what it is. There it is, a beautiful piano. That was. I want to give a big shout out to somebody who stepped into the breach because we were missing one here at the library. Cambridge Pianos and Jim Nicoloro, particularly. Jim Nicoloro.
He's my piano tutor.
Are you serious?
Is that true? Oh, that's great.
Jim Nicoloro.
Yes, he is.
Cambridge
Pianos. Cambridge Piano.
It takes a village, so a big
thank
round
you.
Of applause.
It's a great
for,
piano
thank
tutor.
Thank you, Brian. Good luck on the 19th, and thank you.
Thank you so much
fabulous.
For being here.
Thank you so much.
That's again, if you want to get tickets, rockportmusic.org, and thanks fabulous. Again to GBH. It's Brian O'Donovan, for host of A Celtic Sojourn.
Wow.
Thank you so much, Niamh Trier, for coming in. Up next, what are you talking about, Jim?
It's almost embarrassing to go from this to the mundane. We're going to talk. It's sales tax weekend this weekend, and Marjorie and I are going to debate. Don't go away. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie, and we're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBHNews. This is humiliating, I would say. Would you not, Marjorie?
It
to
is.
To go from the Niamh Trio and the Celtic Festival in Rockport to this. Well, sales tax weekend is upon us. For 2 days, starting tomorrow, you can live out your wildest New Hampshire fantasies and buy things without the life-changing 6% tax usually imposed here in Massachusetts. There are, of course, restrictions. Anything over $2,500, still taxed. Food, alcohol, marijuana, cars, boats, and gas, still taxed. But that new washer-dryer unit you've been eyeing at Best Buy, that puppy is all yours tax-free. So we want to ask, is the annual holiday, the sales tax holiday, worth your time? If you're a small business owner, does it really help you? Or is it, I believe, just a total gimmick where people just shift the time of their purchases that they would otherwise make to save the 6%. You can call or text us at 877-301-8970 or tweet us at BS Public Radio. Here's my thesis. There are a lot of people out there, for example, I'll make something up. Their microwave broke. And instead of buying their microwave right away, they postpone it, I don't know, 2 or 3 days.
That's right.
Just to save the 6%. And they would buy the microwave anyway. Is that not a reasonable
thing? Well, you know, some of us forgot about the sales tax
holiday.
What
happened to you,
Marjorie?
Well,
I was at Home Depot yesterday paying $258 for a brand new, big, huge microwave oven. And I realized today that I could have saved 6% tax if I had done it over the weekend.
My point exactly.
But
you didn't even wait till the weekend.
Here's the thing about this. You think it's a disgrace.
It's a gimmick. It's a giveaway of tax money.
But you know, it's fun. For people that do remember, I didn't remember tragically, but it's fun. It's sticking it back to the man, you know. It's like getting a parking ticket refund or something like that. Going to the police station, winning your fight with the cops over the parking ticket. It's kind of a makeup for all the things that you feel like you've been screwed by via the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and you get a little deal.
So you
it's
get
like
really...
Black Friday. Remember how people back in the day used to park out in the parking lot at, waiting for their, you know, PlayStation 4, 3, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. They'd have tents. They'd be out there all night. It's a fun event.
No, Black Friday was great. How many people got trampled to death by the crowds? No more than a you know, by the way, the absurdity of this on the seriousness, just for a second, it may be fun. Remember when there used to be display ads in newspapers, like where you worked,
yes,
at the Herald and
yes,
the Globe?
Yes.
If there was ever an ad that said, save 6% on a stove,
right,
would you go buy it?
Well, it's not a big deal.
No. If it said 40 or 50%,
correct,
you might go buy it.
Yep.
Thus proving my point, I believe, that it doesn't really help anybody. It just takes tax money out of state coffers, yeah, which they can use, and the individual business owner or consumer doesn't really benefit because they would have bought the damn thing anyway.
Yeah, well, we'd all be getting a lot of money out of our state coffers of tax money rebates if we hadn't had a five-month vacation,
well,
up there at the legislature, because we
wouldn't
get a lot of money back this year, but that didn't happen. Jim wants to take it away and ruin everybody's fun.
Charlie Baker, by the way, wanted 2 months. Do you know that? Charlie Baker wanted a two-month sales tax holiday this season, but the legislature just said no, and so we have tomorrow. I don't even know what date tomorrow is. 13th and 14th,
I think so,
are the sales. So we want to know where you are on this. You think it's a gimmick and it's not worth the $20 or $30 million the state costs up, or do you think it's, what'd you say, a fun
thing? It's kind of a fun thing.
We'd
to
love
do
to hear from a small business
Everybody
owner, too.
Likes to save a few bucks, and they particularly like to save it at the expense of the government. You know what I mean?
Okay, let's take some calls.
Paul and Worcester, thank
Hi, Paul,
you for calling.
How are you?
Hi, Marjorie and Jim. How you doing?
Oh, this is the Paul.
Is this my secretariat coaster, Paul?
This is your secretariat coaster.
Oh, my God.
By the way, there's something wrong with you, Paul. Let me tell you. Why don't you tell him what you tell the audience?
A coaster of, you made it, a coaster of secretariat with a tremendous machine on the bottom. It was unbelievable. How did you do that, Paul?
Computer programmed my router and watched it do its thing.
Very sad.
It was unbelievable.
She loves it, Paul.
I love it.
What do you think about sales tax weekend there, Paul from Worcester?
Well, this year, usually I just ignore it. I have no interest in it. There's too many people and all that kind of thing. But this year I happened to be buying wood lathe, and I put it off for a week so I could save the money on all the stuff I'm buying.
And would you have bought it anyway? My point, you just put it off. But so what is the point? You save a couple of bucks, and the business doesn't benefit because Paul would have bought the damn thing anyway. Correct, Paul?
Absolutely, yes. I even priced it all out and was ready to go. And then I said, oh, it's tax-free weekend in a week or two. I'll just wait.
But let me ask you something, Paul. How do you feel about saving that 6%?
Most fun he's ever had.
When you get up to the cash register. Mm-hmm.
If it's for free, then it's for me. That's how I feel.
Oh, you are my kind of guy, Paul. Paul, thank you for the call, and thank you for the coaster. Marjorie totally loves it.
I am surprised.
Like a tremendous machine.
Yeah, there we go. That's my wonderful secretariat.
That is Secretariat going down the stretch, by the way. On
the Belmont
way
Stakes.
To the huge,
if you haven't seen it, YouTube Secretariat Belmont.
I think
Belmont
they've all
Stakes
seen it because
it's
of you,
absolutely
Marjorie
an unbelievable thing to see. You know, you were somebody that when you say a nice shirt, Jim, nice pair of pants, you have to tell them it was a bargain and how much you paid for
correct
it.
Correct.
So I don't know why you can't see how people can get into this.
Because I don't consider 6% a bargain.
Oh, okay.
I consider 60% a bargain. That's my point. It is nickels and dimes. You know what the companies do that are really smart? Some of the furniture companies, for example, I've heard ads this week. They triple the 6%.
Yeah.
Or they quadruple the 6%.
Yeah, I think Jordan's Furniture,
I don't know
aren't they doing
they,
that?
Well, we shouldn't advertise for them because we don't know if that's true. But regardless,
they're advertising something.
Here is Amber from Worcester. It's a gimmick and a nightmare for us introverts who hate the shop. I'll be hiding at home all weekend. That's the saddest text we ever got, Amber. Thank you very much for the call, for the text.
Alan from Weymouth.
Hey,
do you
Alan
want to get rid of this like Jim wants to, or do you want to enjoy your 6% deal?
Hey, Alan, welcome.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim. Hi.
Hey.
Well, there's different types of personalities to take into account. If briefly, one type of personality doesn't like to pay tax at all, so that person might just buy because there's an opportunity not to pay tax.
I think that's true.
Exactly.
That's true.
Get even with the
another,
man.
Another one is what you just mentioned. Kind of stole my thunder. Sorry, but
say it again.
There are smart stores that will juice it up by tripling it or increasing it, adding another 25%, something like that. And those stores will gain sales that would not have normally occurred.
Right, using the 6% thing as a wedge. So what are you buying this weekend, Alan, based upon this analysis of yours?
I might buy some appliances.
Well, there you go.
And appliances are a lot of money.
Well, there you go. Alan, thank you for the call.
Microwave oven costs $250.
By the way, how do you feel about the fact that you, if you'd waited 2 days, you would have saved money? Did it not even occur to you that you could wait 2 days?
Well, you're the mathematician, so you're telling me it was big nothing.
You're the one who thinks it's a big deal.
Because I think it's fun to plan for it. I mean, I didn't know about it.
Well, you could have saved $15.
I could have saved $15. So I would have felt better that it was not $258. I would have felt better if it was $240-something, whatever that would have been, minus 15. Let's go to Craig in Cape Cod. What do you think, Craig?
All right.
Hey. Hi.
Yeah.
Oh,
this is where you say something, because you called us.
Can you hear me now?
Yes,
I think we can.
I can hear
go
you.
Ahead, Craig.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I think you have to turn the radio. It's going well so far. Hi, Craig. How are you? Let's start again. Hello, Craig from Cape Cod. What's up?
My life is good. So let's see. My wife loves buying all this stuff.
Yeah.
She always wins.
Yeah.
Doing it.
Yeah.
Totally thought about it this time. So that's awesome.
Hey, Craig, you know what we got to do? I hate to do this to you after that false start. It's a bad connection. Don't go away. We'll put you on hold. We'll take another call, and we'll come back to you. Whoops, he hung up. He was going to say, according to our call screener, that he hates it and his wife loves it. There's a family divide, sort of like over Trump in many families.
We have two questions for you, Jim.
What's that?
The first is, how many meals would Jim cram into 2 days if it were meals tax-free weekend?
I would eat until I passed out. That
okay,
is
there
true.
There you go. And then we have another one. Why wait for tax-free day when I can just drive to New Hampshire and buy whatever I want?
Because it's illegal. Marjorie goes to New Hampshire. I don't want to out you, but no.
No,
Marjorie goes
one.
To New Hampshire and stuffs stuff in her trunk. Which is,
I think.
Can I finish here?
Yeah, okay.
You're entitled to stuff stuff in your trunk, but when you do it tax-free and you possess it back here,
Gene.
You have to declare. Jim is not Gene.
Jim.
Gene is somebody else. You have to declare on your income tax that you got a tax-free thing from New Hampshire. So what you do so blithely is illegal. It's
Jim,
illegal.
You know how you say, I stole your story about the piece of cheese and the cockroaches?
Yeah.
It's you're the one that was stuffing things in your trunk.
I didn't say I didn't. I was talking about you, though.
Refrigerator. It was not me. By the way, one of our staff says that her former employer, Zoe, the Eagle Tribune in Lawrence, used to have reporters stake out the state line to catch Massachusetts lawmakers going across the state line to buy things tax-free.
That could be fun.
I love that. That is a great. That is a great idea. That's like when they have the evacuation day or something. This is a local holiday here in Boston. Yeah. And then at the Boston Herald, we used to stake out the
what they're doing.
Yeah, the lawmakers to see if they were really celebrating evacuation day or if they were at the mall. And they were usually at the mall.
Do you think they're celebrating their 5 month vacation right now? I hate to be a broken record.
Well, that's
record,
why they can't
why
do anything because as the head of the house, Mariano said, "What's his first name?"
Mr. Mariano.
I think it's Richard or Roger or something.
Know.
Ron, thank you very much. I knew it was an R one. Yeah, he said that we have vacation plans, and that's why they couldn't do the people's
bidding.
Gotta
do what you gotta do.
Eric in the car, what do you think?
Hey, Eric?
Eric,
what's up?
Well, first of all, leave it to Jim to keep anybody from trying to save a buck.
Exactly.
That's about right. Yeah.
Guilty, guilty. Go ahead.
I live in Haverhill, about 3 miles from New Hampshire, and this weekend I'd be willing to buy things in Massachusetts I'd go across the border for normally.
There you go.
I have to say,
that's a very good
that
point.
Is the best argument in favor we've heard. That is a really good argument for people on the New Hampshire border. Eric, you got me on that one. Thank you.
I have to add that to my arsenal for the next time we discuss
this.
We have discussed this now about 20 times, Jim.
We do a lot of things, 20. We've been on the air a long time.
But I think you wanted me to.
You know what this bag is, by the way, unrelated? The other day, we're talking to Michael Curry, who is on the National NAACP board, and he's from the head of the League of Community Health Centers in Massachusetts. He's always somewhere. He's either at the Margarita Hotel in Times Square in New York City. And so we say, where are you? Do you remember where he was?
He was at a wedding in Mexico.
In Mexico. And the guy getting married is the head of King Boston, Amari Paris Jeffries, who apparently heard secondhand, because he was in Mexico, that we were evincing some jealousy that we hadn't been invited. This is a gift from Mexico. It has not been opened yet. It's from Amari himself. Is it not, Jamie?
Is
that what the deal is?
Oh, my gosh.
And I think, is it tequila? Whatever it is, it's tequila or something, we'll tell you. So, Amari, if you're listening, thank you and congratulations on the wedding.
Oh, thank you very much.
And Mike will be with us next week. We can get to the bottom of this.
Lori from Brockton, you're here on the tax-free weekend. What do you think?
Hey, Lori, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to get in real quick.
Please.
when my mother died about 10 years ago, in July, my father waited till tax-free weekend to get her headstone.
That is not... That is not...
Honest to God.
Well, better than waiting to get the casket wait a until second. Tax-free weekend.
Yes. Lori, raise your right hand. Is that really true?
I raised all my hands.
Is that really true?
That's a great story.
I went with him over in Quincy.
That is the best one.
We went in and we bought it on tax-free weekend because he wanted to save the tax.
Now, did anybody in the family, you or a sibling, say that maybe... You know, that's almost like burying Ivana at the golf course so that Trump could get a tax break. I mean...
No, because our family is very odd, and we actually buried my dad in his pajamas.
Well, why wouldn't you? And you waited until pajamas were on sale to do it, right?
He had a brand new pair waiting.
Oh, that's
good. That's good.
No, we were all sitting around chatting one day. How do you want to be buried? What do you want to wear? My father says, if I'm going to be laying down sleeping... forever, I want to be comfortable. I want my pajamas.
Can I tell you, I would have loved your father. I really would have loved
Lori,
this
that's
guy.
That's a great story.
One of the great calls ever. Thanks, Lori. We appreciate it.
Okay, we have two people who are on my side. Listen to this. I worked at a small pet supply shop for 5 years on tax-free days. People who ordinarily just bought food, bought fun items, toys and treats. The businesses always did really well at purchases people ordinarily
that they would not
make.
Otherwise buy because they saved 6 cents on a dollar?
That's right. And then this other person says, I love the opportunity to prove Jim wrong. They're proving you wrong, Jim. I needed to buy a new computer, and my friend advised me to wait an extra 2 weeks for tax-free weekend. It's been 11 years since my last computer purchase, so what's an extra 2 weeks? And this person spent the extra $200 on Red Sox tickets for her husband. I would certainly have only bought the computer otherwise. So how about that? Night out at Fenway with the $200 that they
saved. How much does a tombstone cost anyway?
I do not know, Jim. I'm not planning on having to buy one. I hope anytime soon. I've not investigated. Roy from Cambridge, what do you think?
If you do, you should wait till tax-free weekend.
Absolutely.
Roy in Cambridge, what's up? Quickly, please.
Hey there. And from Norwood, too. Love your customer service department. So I write tickets as part of my job. I'm a state employee.
You are.
And Marjorie, I want people to enjoy paying their parking tickets, please.
Yeah, that's a tough one, Roy.
Love
that's a tough one.
That's a tough job, by the way, too.
It is.
People treat you like crap.
They do. But I went to the police department in Brookline when I got a parking ticket when the parking meter was broken, and they took it away from me, no questions asked.
What happened to the fire
that.
Department in Brookline when they came to your house in the middle of the night once?
Well, you know, firefighters are very handsome.
Excuse me?
6 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, you see six firefighters come trudging in. It was a big thrill for us all, Jim.
I thought they were upset with you because you were not being kind to public safety officials, public employees on the radio.
You're mixing up yet another story. Not firefighters, Jim.
It was cops.
Not firefighters.
It was Brookline cops.
Yeah, that was a different story.
Of course it was. And luckily for you,
we're
out of time.
We are done. Okay, thank you very much, everybody that came down to the Boston
Public
Library.
Thank you all for coming.
Appreciate people showing up. We do have a podcast, as we said before.
We do.
It's, of course, called the Boston Public Radio Podcast. If you haven't had enough of us already, on Monday we're going to be joined by comedian Lewis Black. That's going to be really
great.
Fun. The Atlantic's Arthur Brooks, who writes the happiness column, and who does not want to be happier? The Reverend Zaire Monroe and Emma G. Price. The Boston Globe's Shirley the Young, plus author Jessie Klein, a really talented writer, on her new book, I'll Show Myself Out, Essays on Midlife and Motherhood.
I started reading it last night, by the way.
Oh,
I didn't
she's
think
really
it was
good.
My kind of
she's
book. It's great.
Really
she's
good.
Really good.
We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, Rebecca Tauber, Gia Orsino, our engineer, John the Claw Parker. Our executive producer is Jamie Bologna, and our crew here at the BPL today, the engineering crew, Sai Patel, Colin Cockrell, and Rob Fagnett. We want to thank them for the great job.
If people realize how hard it is to prepare this music to sound as good in person and on the radio.
Yep.
And you know what I'm going to do, Marjorie,
because
I'm often so inspired by you.
Yeah,
and you are creative and do different things. I'm going to say now what, again, following your lead, I am Marjorie Egan. That's what you said yesterday.
I know. I got us mixed up, Jim.
Okay,
hard to believe.
I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy.
Yes.
Thank you very much for tuning in today.
Thank you. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thank you again for coming down to the library. I hope you can tune in on Monday. And meanwhile, have a great weekend.
Have a great
weekend. Nice and cool.
Bye.